This is HPR episode 2249 entitled HPR New Year Show episode 3. It is hosted by various hosts and is about 225 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is Hacker Public Radio New Year's Eve Show episode 3.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
So, at the risk of bringing everyone down, 2016 has been a hell of a year for missing, for losing celebrities, hasn't it?
Yeah, and Syrians.
Well, that too. But no, a lot of the big, I mean, I'm in my 40s now, so a lot of the people that I knew as celebrities in the sort of the 80s and the 90s, a lot of them, are the big names then, are sort of dying off now. It's just one after the other. It's like, what? It's like 2016 seems to be a year where a lot of people are dying, a lot of big names are dying. I think possibly the biggest downer after George Michael on Christmas Day was Carrie Fisher, and then Debbie Reynolds the day after that was just so sad. And they don't call me Tumbleweed for nothing.
I can safely say I'm not really too big in the celebrity world. You know, like hang out with a bunch of hackers on New Year's Eve.
Well, neither am I. Just things I've noticed on the news just over the last year. So big names that I would consider to be like big names all have to die a lot.
How there's some Linux people I've been hanging out with for about 4.5 years.
Who's that?
A whole bunch of them, about 2 or 3 dozen.
Yeah, I mean, one of our own passed this year, too, Lord D.
Oh, passed away?
Yeah, Lord D is no longer with us. I don't remember if the eulogy show ever made it out to HPR yet. If it did, I just spoiled it.
Oh, that's a shame. There was one Mumble channel I used to hang out on, Linux Distro Community. My favorite guy over there, he died. What was his name? Preacher. Yeah, he was awesome.
Yeah, the last I heard, I think it was probably 2 years ago, Lord D was kind of ill. But then, obviously, I've been sort of pretty much offline for the last year and a half. That's sad, he's gone. I mean, in hindsight, I probably kind of guessed that would have been happening by now, but yeah, that's kind of sad.
Just to bring up the topic of something else, has anyone seen that the FSF is looking for a year-end donation drive?
Yes, I did see that. There was an email directly to me from Richard Selman because I used to be an FSF member. I felt like a nice little dull place after that, the Rich Diamond Bell, which was good. But I felt like it's a little bit annoying that every year that goes by at the end, these organisations that used to be a member of, they go, oh, donate to us again. I'm getting it from Wikipedia as well, because I donated to them as a one-off once. every year they come out with their email saying, donate to us again. And apparently they don't need as much money anyway. Wikipedia, I remember somebody saying to me before as well.
Yeah, about that, I think it was the Software Freedom Conservancy actually had a checkbox when you donated, said, please never contact me again. And I was like, okay, now that you have actually put that box on your website, and if you actually honor it, I don't remember if I checked it or not, then that actually would want me to make me donate again, because there's certain organizations that continually beg for me for money, and it's just like, look, you're wasting your time. You keep begging me for money, and I've already given you what I have chosen to give you this year. And I usually do like a couple thousand dollars at the end of the year just for tax reasons. And it's like, look, you know, if you keep begging me for money over the course of the year, I'm not going to give you that. And I usually pick a different charity. Like I've picked the Free Software Foundation. I've done Software Freedom Conservancy. I've done Software in a Public Interest, which is the Debian charity. And, you know, I usually rotate through them. I think I did Jonathan Nadeau's charity, the Accessible Computing Foundation, 1 year on this show even. And I have found that, like, I don't like being asked for that. I have money. I know that, you know, it's like, I know you exist. And if I like what you do, I will give you the money. But those fundraising drives are important. It's just when you oversaturate somebody with requests, they become less receptive to you. And a couple charities that I have donated to and become members of, like the ACLU, are just particularly bad at understanding that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I agree with that. If they keep on pushing you to donate, you're less likely to do that. And we went to another topic, but I see Duban putting some comments in the chat, and dare I bring this topic up? We might as well have the discussion, because I haven't actually heard it all so far, listening to this. The discussion of, dare I perhaps say this, Trump and Brexit as well. Actually, Scott, the official, but I assume you aren't particularly happy about all that Brexit stuff, like a lot of us. Are you still there?
Yeah, Brexit was a huge thing about, you know, like basically people were saying that, like, they didn't think their vote counted. It's one of the biggest problems of what they call plebiscite democracy, which is this idea that, you know, everybody votes, not just representatives. It's, you know, democratic versus a republic, that difference. And Brexit was people thinking that their vote just didn't count, and it counted.
Well, their vote didn't count with the EU. You look, there really isn't any lawmaking body that has any control by the voters.
Right, but I'm talking about the British commoner, like the British people inside the British government, talking about how they didn't feel that their vote counted. Like, they thought the whole, like, Brexit thing was just an exercise in casting a vote, and they didn't think it mattered what they voted for.
Yeah, I think that was partly the problem there as well, is that a lot of people who normally wouldn't even bother voting, they did actually get a vote, and then they voted leave. That was a good example. There's somebody I know online, haven't met her, but I know her online for a few years, and from Wales, and she said... And I said once, what did you vote for? And she was like, I voted leave. And I said, why did you vote leave? And she was like, oh, I did eeny, meeny, miny, mo. And then leave is the one that won. So she voted leave. Which is, you know, you kind of think if one person did that, how many other people did that? Basically voting just for the sake of it and not really knowing what they're doing, really. And then the votes were very close. It was very close, but the mostly won. However, not in Scotland, where Gordon is from. I think he's just come back now, which is perfect. And up in Scotland, they're very annoyed about this in general. Well, that's the impression we get on the TV from their First Minister. And it would be interesting to see what Gordon has to say about the whole Brexit thing. Well, I think he just came back, actually.
You can equally say a lot of people that voted to stay didn't know voting for either. They don't even know how the European Union works.
Yeah, technically I wasn't aware. I was just sort of not speaking. How's my sound? Before I give any views on the Brexit thing, how's my sound? Because I've knocked down, judging by the settings of Fleet and the settings and the chat thing, I've dropped my settings a little bit. How's that sound?
Sounds a lot
absolutely
better.
Absolutely great.
Oh, Nathan, Jesus, that's fine. Better.
Seriously, is that better?
Absolutely. Fine.
Yeah, much better.
Right, do you want me to drop it another touch again to see if I can improve it some more? Or?
You're understandable now.
I think that will do,
to be
honest. Gordon, I think that will be fine for tonight. We can hear you fine enough.
All right, okay. So sound check's all good, right? That's fine. So I can get back to the alcoholic water and the bottle mark vodka mixed with orange and not worry about it. Right, okay, I just need to find the button. Right, okay. On the Brexit thing, I voted to stay. That's not a vote in confidence of the EU. It's just not. It's like, I don't know is like there's a lot of things that while we're under the control of Westminster, I think I would rather have some protection from the EU. The EU is far from perfect. It's really far from perfect. I'm not in favour of that at all. What I was heartened to see in the results was the whole of Scotland, the entirety of Scotland, all 100% of Scotland voted to stay in the EU. So that's
really... Well, about 90% probably, really. But yeah, most of Scotland.
Yeah, so it was kind of 50-50 in England, with most, probably 54-55% to leave in England. In Wales, sort of 50-50, sort of 52-53 voted to leave. In Northern Ireland, it was kind of 50-50 again, where it edged on voting to stay. But in Scotland, it was 100%. The whole of Scotland voted to stay in the EU. And that is for me, the solace I'm taking from this is the fact that Scotland will be independent within 4 or 5 years. This will trigger another independence for Scotland. That's the silver lining for me. So I don't, England can vote for whoever they want. That's democracy.
And you're going to be an independent, you're going to be an independent member of European, which doesn't allow countries to be independent anyway. So what's the point?
Well, the EU is an expansionist thing. They want people to join, they want countries to join. So, and we are already aligned with the EU in terms of our laws and things like that. So it's a no-brainer. That's the way I see it. It's a no-brainer. That's why I'm not all at all with the result.
Yeah, but the only thing with the independence vote is that apparently, Westminster has to agree to that to go forward, and she knows full well that if she says yes to that at the moment, then it's probably going to be Scotland leaving the UK. So they would try and stop that from happening as much as they can.
Well, that is true. That is true. However, you look at that and say, well, it's not as if what we keep hearing in Scotland is that there's not that much difference between the Scots and the English and the Irish and the Welsh. We're all broadly the same. We've all got broadly the same outlook in the world. And in certainly, I don't know about Northern Ireland, but in certainly in England and Wales, you could argue that's kind of similar. The parties that do well in one country also do well in another. And the same sort of the Brexit votes were kind of more or less very similar between the two countries. In Scotland, that's not the case. In Scotland, the UK parties have really struggled in the elections recently, and the Brexit votes we've 100%, the entire country voted to stay, whereas it was a very mixed vote on in England and Wales. And as far as contributor or taker, as far as I'm aware, the oil has been a net contributor to the UK. It's Scotland and London that make up the vast majority of the contribution to the UK tax coffers.
Why does Scotland want to give up their independence to the European Union?
The difference, as I understand it, is where we are part of the UK, it's the UK have a certain amount of votes. For example, on fishing, the UK has a certain amount of votes, like whether it is 21 or whatever it is on any particular issue, and they have all the votes. Whereas if Scotland might have like 5 of those votes. So if we are independent, then we would have 5 votes to vote in our own interests, rather than having Westminster use those 5 votes to add to the other 16 or something like that that they've got. That's the difference. It's where Scotland, at the moment, in the EU, we are at the children's table, where we can voice an opinion, but it's someone else that speaks on their behalf. Whereas in as a member in our own right, we can speak on our own behalf. That might not make much of a difference, but in some cases it might.
The UK has trouble standing up for its own interests, so I really, and a lot of the other countries do as well, so how will small Scotland even have any chance?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. But hey, at least, you know, that, and in some cases, it's majority rules. In a lot of cases, majority rules. And that's fine. I'm happy with that.
There's no Scottish Trump to bring back Scottish nationalism, is there?
No, as far as I'm aware, and I wouldn't have it either way. Scottish, the whole SNP thing isn't about, as I understand Trump's nationalism, it's about American as a people born in America who believe in the American ideal. It's almost like, I don't know if he's playing into the sort of white nationalist thing, but it's very America first. Where I see the SNP in Scotland, I mean, I'm of no party, but the way that I see that the Scottish National Party is about the people of Scotland rather than Scottish. The people of Scotland are, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can work out, the SNP believe the same, is the people who have chosen to make their homes and make their lives and their futures in Scotland. Doesn't matter where they were born, doesn't matter what their skin colour, what their religion is, if they've chosen to come to Scotland and make their lives here and raise their children here and work here and benefit the economy here, they are the people of Scotland, and that's who I back.
And Trump's not like that.
Yeah, I mean, the SNP is basically a Scotland, the people of Scotland first sort of party. It's all about Scotland, Scotland's interests. But it's not so much about who is actually Scottish, who was born there. I think I probably agree with Pistol Web here. Anybody who lives in Scotland would be seen as Scottish under the SNP. Basically, I think that's basically what Gordon is trying to say as well.
See, I don't know about where you guys live at, but I pretty much figured out that right here in the United States, our votes don't count anymore.
Exactly, and I think that's the way that I look at it. I've set up a new website that I've not put any posts on yet. My old one's gone. But I was keep meaning to get around to putting a point of, this is waves. This is different waves. One of them put Trump into power, and I'm not surprised. I'm really not surprised. Obama was elected on a promise of, or a pledge of change, hope of change, something different from Bush, something like there's going to be a new America. And then the people, the American voters, Democratic and Republican, thought, we are sick to the back teeth of the same old, we will vote in, this guy wants to do something different, we will give him a chance. And he came in 2008 and doubled down on all of the Bush stuff. All the stuff that the American people didn't want, he just doubled down on. So he rose that hope, he rode that wave of hope all the way into the White House and then betrayed the people. So years later on than that, you've got the, there's probably other steps in this that I'm missing out. But skipping forward, you've got the Scottish independence referendum in 2014, where the UK, the English establishment, the UK establishment wanted to keep Scotland as part of the UK, and it was supposed to be an easy victory, and yet it came so close to going the other way. Followed by that, you've got the turning off of where Scotland always used to vote Labour MPs into the general election, that all changed, and we swept the SNP into power representing Scotland in Westminster. That was against the sort of UK establishment. The next wave of that was where Labour put their new leaders out, and they had three kind of establishment people and then one left wing oddball, and the public went with the left wing oddball, which was Jeremy Corbyn. You know, and then the next sort of wave of populism was the anti-establishment guy, was either Hillary Clinton, who is seriously corrupt, but that aside, she is full-on establishment, US establishment, and the people said, you know what, we don't want establishment, we've had enough of the establishment, we want something different. And the only thing that was different, initially it looked like Sanders and Trump, but Sanders was always going to be stitched up, so the only option they had was Trump, and that's why Trump's came to power. So we want something different, they need something different, that's the whole
thing. Yeah, I hear you. But what I found out is that, you know, every single president that we've had here in the United States, with exception of one president, are all related to the same exact king way back in England. And then Obama wasn't really a natural born United States citizen. Trying to say that he was born in Hawaii, that's a bunch of bullshit. His birth certificate is a fake birth certificate.
That's bullshit, and you know it.
And then
Obama was born in a U.S. territory at the time. It's the same reason all Puerto Rico people are considered citizens of the U.S., because Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory. This was before Hawaii became a state. This birther crap is bullshit. I wanted to jump back to the other thing where you were talking about how Obama came in on Hope and Change, Gordon. If you've ever seen a YouTube video, look up. It's called Candidate Obama versus President Obama. They take the two statements and put them against each other, and it is striking how different he sounds now.
I agree with you. I totally agree. And that's my point, is the fact that he ran for president on this change agenda. He promised he was the candidate of change. And then once the people bought into that and said, yes, we back you. Like, give us change. Give us something different. We will give you a vote. We put you into power. And then at that point, he suddenly became the same as Bush. So I totally agree with you. I so agree with you. And that's my point, is the fact that he promised one thing and he was elected on that one thing. And then he turned out to be just the same as before.
And to go to another point, the whole reason the 13th Amendment was there, or I think it's the 14th, whatever one it says, you're born here, you're a citizen, was to clean up after the whole slavery debacle in 1865. I think Canada has a similar, if you're born here, you're a citizen policy. And it's causing problems for them too. I don't think the current model is sustainable, but it's the law of the land. And so if you're going to change it, you have to do that through the constitutional process.
But wasn't that introduced in the 60s? That extradition was introduced in the 60s, I understood, a little bit later even.
In where?
In the US, the right to be, if you're born in America, you become a citizen. I thought that was introduced much later, more recently.
No, it's the 1860s. It was right after
slavery. That's the name of it?
It's the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I think it's the 13th. Let me look.
Anyhow, what you do, this is what you do. Number one, find out exactly how old President Obama is and what his birthday is. Okay? Then you take and you subtract that from the year right now today. And then you check out, you look at all the birth certificates within about 3 months before he was born and 3 months after he was born, that came out of that same hospital, that same city, and I'll tell you what, his does not match the others.
Yeah, it's the 14th Amendment.
As far as I'm led to believe, obviously I'm not American, but as far as I'm led to believe, the whole Obama birther thing came from Clinton's team when she was running against Obama in 2008. That was the origin of that. And then the Republicans just ran with it. Obama won the candidacy of the Democratic Party in 2008 and went on to become president. And the Republicans, some of them ran with it in the hopes that they would get something out of it. But it turned out to be complete bollocks. It was nothing. It was absolutely nothing. And it originated from Clinton.
Anyhow, logically, I look at things like this. If every single solitary president since the beginning has been related to the same king,
all with the exception of one. That's telling me that the next president we get is going to be related to that king also. So we don't have a choice, see?
Which king? Hashtag Illuminati confirmed.
Which king?
Just a second, I'll find out.
What do they call it in the US when you deliberately try and have a baby, you get your baby born there so that get American citizenship?
The slang is anchor, baby.
Anchor. Ah, that's the one. Yeah, thanks.
Evidently, it's a pretty big thing with more wealthy Chinese now.
Russians, too.
Mexicans as well, man.
On a slightly lighter note, but in the same subject, I happened to spot a series on the History Channel. It was something about the American presidents. It was a 13-episode series, and it took you through all the way through from the first President Washington all the way through to Obama, and that was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating. I knew about a little bit of Washington, mostly about Lincoln, and then Nixon, and then the kind of modern-day guys like Bush and Obama, whatever. But that was fascinating, learning things about Jackson and all these people. And yeah, it was where things like where they moved from New York as the capital to Washington, and where they had the idea of the vice president taking over the presidency, and all the kind of precedents that were set during the different eras. And that was a fascinating series, a 13-part series on the History Channel, and it was amazing. Even as a foreigner, that was amazing.
Oh, that king was John Lackland.
Yeah, this king thing, I've never heard of this before. So if that is true, that the king, that sounds like some interesting general knowledge, I guess. But yeah, it sounds interesting.
And I know that everybody's got their own problems and everything like that, but what really bothered me a long time ago is I found out that the Queen of England is not really the legitimate heir to the throne. That there's a guy that's in Australia that's actually the legitimate heir.
There's a guy in France who's named Louis Bourbon, and people think he's descended from the kings, too. It doesn't change France.
Yeah, I know.
There's a guy in France that thinks he's descended from Jesus Christ. Guess we all should bow down to him or something.
Yeah, I think the British monarch is, up until sort of about 100 years ago maybe, this was basically a German monarchy. They had German names, and then obviously when Britain went to war in the Great War with Germany, they thought, you know what, maybe not a good idea if our surnames were German, so maybe we should change their name, and then they decided to pick Windsor.
Their name is Saxe-Gotha.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Personally, I have no time for... I am one of those people who are proudly Republican, but that's not as in the American political party. That's in I do not have any time for a monarchy or a royal system. I do not affiliate with anything.
GCHQ is getting you.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. I can see the sort of flashing on my screen here.
Well, yeah, I mean, depending on how you look at it, with the British system, the whole idea of having a royal family is not as relevant as it once was, or it still is relevant. It really depends on how you look at it, because it's mostly just a government.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I do... Logically, I accept that, yeah, I get it, the queen and the monarchy, whatever. But me personally, I have no queen, I have no king, I will never have a queen or a king. I don't give a shit who's in charge of Buckingham Palace or whatever. I do not respect a title that's by birth. I just don't. I'm all about meritocracy, and from that perspective, I am a Republican.
Yeah, I'm not going to label myself. I'm just going to say that I'm an independent. I'm a little bit of everything, so I'm independent, you know. That video right there, in that video, you'll see who the real heir is to the throne of England.
Yeah, although, Gordon, I was just thinking, the Queen and all that, it's really the Queen of England, isn't it? Although, saying that as well, they also have their, the Canadian... head of, well, there's like a link, isn't there? Where they still mean something in Canada, for example.
Yeah, the thing is, a lot of the reason why I refuse, right, so I'll go back a bit. When it came to the Scottish referendum, the Scottish independence referendum 2014, I had not even considered whether I was Scottish or British. Not even occurred to me. It was just flip a coin, one or the other. And once I started thinking about it, I realised I was Scottish. I'm not British. I'm never British. I am Scottish. And the reason for that is I do not associate myself with things that associate themselves with the Union Jack, with the British flag. Things like the past 200, 300 years of colonization, of slave trading, of abuse, of taking over different countries, of thinking we have the right to control and decide who leads other countries and all that kind of stuff. That's the things that come from the kind of the Westminster thing that come from that, and it's like that's not me. I am not that person. For me, I'm looking at the ideals of what the Scottish Parliament and what the Scottish government want to be is like. We want to be a country with happy within our own rights. We want to work with other people and respect other people and all that. That was where I came from. So, yeah. So the idea of the whole kind of slave, the whole history of the flag and the whole history of that is just I don't agree with at all. And a lot of that's establishment of of what's British values kind of thing.
Yeah, but a lot of countries have bad history anyway, not just Britain in that sense. But what I was going to say is, I would say I'm more European than British. Well, I'm half Swedish as well, so it's actually born in Sweden, but lived in England most of my life. So, but I always say I'm more European than anything else. Plus, I like going to Europe anyway. I'd like going to the mainland of Europe, going somewhere.
But you don't have to
Now
be in the
that's
European Union to go to Europe, do you? That's another lie they've told us. Or to use other people's money, the lie.
well, to get back to that whole that I'm everyone's all mixed up. It's like,
Wait,
yeah.
hold on a sec. Hold on. What was that? What was Steve Man saying?
Go ahead. I'll defer.
Yeah, sorry, I jumped in front of you. I'll be quick. But we don't have to be in the European Union to still enjoy being European brothers and sisters, to travel, to share and collaborate. Most people don't even know how the European works, or how it functions, or what their motives are, or what the history of it is, And before someone, I think Gordon was talking about Donald Trump, and it seemed that he'd been watching too much mainstream news. Which I'm concerned about who pays for and who funds that particular mainstream news. And if you can trust the bias or the slant they put onto everything when they talk about Trump, then no wonder people think that he's a terrible white nationalist, racist person, And people just have trouble finding or don't have enough time to find more useful news. I will carry on.
I'll jump. I'll quit that real quick and I'll jump back. The big thing is that now with the internet, we have all this information coming at us, and there's really no good way to sift through it. We've lost a lot of, ways of doing. People don't get taught critical thinking anymore. To wit, that the whole thing about all the presidents being related, it's like, depending on how far you go up the family tree, it's amazing who's related to everybody else. Genghis Khan has a genetic marker on his Y chromosome. There are an estimated 175 million people with that genetic marker, and that's just men because it's on the Y chromosome. So you have a ridiculous number of people that are all related to Genghis Khan. The fact that, if you, depending on how far you're willing to go up a family tree and say, I'm sure I'm close cousins with a significant number of people here, due to the fact that half my family has been in this country since the American Revolution, and the other half of this country, my family is like maybe 3 to 4 generations removed from being immigrants. So depending on where, so you say, some of you say I'm mixed up here. It's like, yeah, well, I'm an American melting pot, Heinz 57, Eurotrash, white boy. If you have family anywhere in Europe or Western Asia, I'm probably related to you in some way. So this idea doesn't pass muster that all these presidents are related to a king. It's like, yeah, probably because a good portion of the population is, not because it's deliberate.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you wanted to go all the way back, we could all say, hey, we are related because of, like, mitochondrial Eve.
Yeah, I think so much of America is really founded on immigration. It's founded on so many people from the old world, from Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales, wherever, all coming to America and becoming, over the generations, becoming American, becoming their own thing, Italian Americans or Irish Americans or whatever, then you guys have all got that kind of mixed heritage if you go back enough generations. For me, I've always been curious. I mean, as far as I'm aware, my entire heritage has been Scottish, but that makes me feel like lesser to everyone else, because like everyone else is mixed heritage somehow. Surely I must have something other than Scottish in my bloodline. Surely I must have, and I'll need to check into that one day, because it feels like I'm missing out somehow. Like I should be more than just what I am.
Don't fall for the multiculturalism, you know, we all know who's been pushing that. Maybe you don't, but there's nothing wrong, and maybe it's good to for different species, different clans or groups to have some kind of purity and to know what they're doing. You know, I wouldn't want my cows breeding with different species and then having a mixture between meat and milk breeds. I know that's an oversimplification, but there are differences between different races of humans, and a lot of people don't want to talk about that. They say, oh, you're racist if you talk about that, but there's we don't all need to be a bit of this and a bit of that.
Hey, you are.
If I'm hungry and there's a cow that has mixed with a different cow, I'm still going to eat it. I don't care.
Yeah, but if you're a farmer and you're trying to maintain a breed for a particular reason, then you're going to chase off your randy neighbor's bull, aren't you?
I was going to say, you are more than what you are, and I can prove it, that each and every one of us is a special, unique individual. And here's my proof, okay? At conception, when a woman gets pregnant, you know, she's got this egg, right? And all these little tiny sperm things go after that egg, right? Well, as soon as the first little sperm enters that egg, all the rest of them take off and leave it alone. So that's unbelievable. I mean, we're talking about millions and trillions of these little sperm things, and only one got into it, and right away, all the rest left and left it alone. So that shows that we're each a unique, special individual.
Survival of the fittest, the strongest got through to maintain the strength and vitality for the future generations. As simple as that.
You know, I don't know. I thought about doing a, a slightly lighter subject, a slightly more comical subject. I thought about, you know, these, when you're in the doctor's surgery and you're waiting for your appointment or a dentist or whatever, and you see all these leaflets on the wall about different things, get checked out for such and such. And I thought about a pregnancy thing, and the leaflet was called The Little Sperm That Could, as in the little horse that could. The one sperm that actually managed to make it to the egg to fertilize the egg, the little sperm that could.
Actually, that's funny.
I don't know about anybody else, but I'm exactly like all of you, except I have a broken foot.
I'm not like any of you, unless you're white.
That reminds me of the train that said, I think I can, I think I can.
Yeah, I think that's where it came from. I knew it was something that was like, the little train that could, yeah, that could well be it. But it came from somewhere. I just thought about that one night and thought, the little sperm that could. That's just so funny.
You know, recently I went to the doctor and I decided to get checked for something, you know, and he was like, hey, good news, you're not pregnant, you're just fat.
Okay, so going back to earlier, what I want to say is that you don't have to be in the EU to be European. You definitely don't have to be in the EU to be European. So Switzerland is not in the EU, and Norway is not in the EU, and they're both very European. And somebody said about Trump and the media, and if you believe all that, well, in England, in Britain, it's mostly been Yeah, it's not been particularly good news about Trump this last year or so from the mainstream media.
And also,
I had another point, but I can't remember what it was. I think it was another point. I guess I haven't really mattered then.
No, carry on. I only wanted to interject. You carry on with your other point, sorry.
No, I thought there was a third thing that I was going to say, but I can't remember now if there was. Never mind then.
To check facts, you could do much worse than checking Wikipedia.
I found Breitbart really interesting. Doesn't anyone else read that?
Or is that propaganda?
Have you heard of Breitbart.com, a news website? Or do people consider that propaganda? I put a link in the thing. It's easier to write than for me to say.
Well, the thing about Wikipedia is it's got multiple references and are cross-checked and I suppose you can have multiple people writing. Anyone to write if you're enjoying Wikipedia. But the references are checked independently. So probably fairly a bit more robust than some of the other sites, I suppose. But I don't know about that site that was previously mentioned.
CNN's good if you like Clinton.
Most colleges won't allow Wikipedia references in papers.
Yeah, but there's still an awful lot better than one independent site, which is, it's far more trustworthy than something like that. It's kind of independent, you know.
I view it as good for scientific or technical things, but anything that's got a political aspect to it is going to have issues on Wikipedia.
On anyone?
Well, not really, because surely there can be independent references from all different sources. Anybody's free to write anything, but it's cross-checked to make sure that it's valid and not false news.
It seems to me.
Take a look at the methods that they use on Wikipedia a little bit. I think you get a little more faith in the system than that is warranted. There's a lot of politics that are played, and there's a lot of power demonstration that goes on within that system, and I think it squishes a lot of stuff. If you don't have power, you can't edit, and the people that have power hoard it there.
I'm not sure about politics on Wikipedia, like how accurate that is, but tech stuff is usually okay, I think. As for editing Wikipedia, I think there's a point there that only certain people can edit it or keep their changes on Wikipedia. Like if you're a guest, they pretty much change it back, and I guess you might have to register to edit properly, but I think there's a lot of that probably actually that the change will go back, they will not stay. Even if you are
on Wikipedia, there's a lot of hot topics, really hot topics that the admins have to sort of lock down on, because you've got like Israel-Palestine is another, is one, like George W. Bush or Tony Blair or whatever. There's a lot of really contentious subjects on Wikipedia that they have their people fiercely sort of pro one side or another, and that it seems to be their passion and their job to sort of set the record one way or the other. So, I mean, for me, I look at Wikipedia as a starting off point. That's my general overview of a subject, and then from there, I explore other things. It gives me an overview and it lets me jump off to other things to sort of learn about it.
Correct. It's a great starting point. The point is that there may be information missing, but there won't be there won't be false information because the references are checked. That's the point.
There's biasness and misinformation, or not being as specific as might be possible. You know, I would say just looking at any source of information, whether it's Breitbart, BBC, CNN, you know, Wikipedia. Just all of us, I'm sure, that we follow even sources we disagree with to see how they tell the story. So the more sources you can look at yourself, then the less any particular bias. Even if you love Trump and you only want to listen to pro-Trump stuff, it's good to listen to the opposite side and then to try to judge and find the hidden part in between, you know, between the lines.
Yeah, but if you've got a particular bias, it's you might tend to head to the wrong sites. at least with Wikipedia, you're getting a whole varied range of references. But I mean, I agree absolutely. You should be doing your own research as well, obviously.
Obviously, when you're looking at anything online, like you're talking sort of degree level study of something, if I think of something like, I don't know, Napoleon, for example, I love Napoleon Bonaparte. I've got so much time for Napoleon Bonaparte. He's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but I would look at him and say, like, what is his story? Now I would look at that and use Wikipedia as a jump off point and say, what happened during this part or what happened during that part? And you're looking at different things and trying to figure out, like, yeah, okay, this individual or this organization may have a reason to have a bias against them, so therefore trying to paint them in a different light. But you cannot get an idea generally. You need to look at a lot of different things and try to figure out where the truth is. And I think Wikipedia is a wonderful kind of starting point. It's a really good starting point to get an overview and then sort of spider off from there.
So the BBC isn't our go-to source of information in the UK anymore. Have they published anything or had any in-depth reports on the Pizzagate yet, or anything like that, the paedophilia in the UK or America?
Well, I don't consider the BBC as that much of a reliable source of news, but as far as we know, they haven't, not with Pizzagate, no.
Ah, now that surprises me.
Now, I've only heard Pizzagate, like, quickly in passing. Can someone give me a quick summary there?
Right. The broad, as far as I understand it, the Pizzagate thing is the allegation, and I stress allegation, that somehow there was a pizza restaurant or fast food place in, I believe, Washington, but I could be wrong, where underage, well, minors, like boys and girls, were being essentially pimped out as prostitutes to wealthy individuals, like politicians or business people or whatever, wealthy people. And that was the allegation, that this was going on and that somehow the Clintons were involved in this. I don't know how, I don't know where the connection was, that they either knew about it or their donors, or there was something there. And yeah, the allegation was that it was an underage, essentially a brothel happening at a pizza restaurant. If you went in and said the right things, then you would get access to their back rooms, which contained underage people being forced as a sex slave, essentially. That's my understanding.
Yeah,
look at Wikipedia and the references to that. That's a good starting point.
Yeah, that's fine. The only additional I'd heard, wasn't it the Podesta leaked emails? There were some emails that the two brothers had sent backwards and forwards, referencing pizza and cream cake or something like this, and these are well-known code words that paedophiles use to describe different things. I don't want to be too specific because he's really bloody sick, but that's what I'd heard or listened to.
You know, for a name like Pizzagate, that is a very dark subject for such a light-sounding sort of title there.
You know, what I have an objection to in terms of, this is going to sound bizarre, and I do sort of forewarn that. What I have an issue is with the idea of attaching the word gate onto any kind of scandal. I've got to assume that everyone here knows where the name gate comes from.
Yeah, it comes from Watergate.
Yeah, and exactly. And what was Watergate? What was the point of Watergate?
It was a wiretapping scandal.
Yeah, and the name of the hotel was called Watergate. It had nothing to do with gate. It was the fact that Watergate was part of the title of the hotel. It was called Watergate. So seriously, I mean, why attach the word gate onto anything? It has no sense whatsoever. It's pointless.
Quick interruption. Hold on. Quick interruption. We missed it by about 8 minutes. Happy New Year's to Greece and 30 more, including Cairo, Athens, Bucharest, and Johannesburg.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah, it's 5:09 p.m. here. It hasn't got New Year's yet.
I understand a big criticism was the kind of artwork that the Podesta brothers have at their homes as well, which really sounds and looks pretty sick.
Finland will be in 2017 as well then. Helsinki and Finland, yeah.
Yeah, no, and this on the thing with scandals, like I get why different things are a scandal. That's completely independent. That's totally fine. But calling it gate, I have a serious objection to calling it something gate, like pizza gate. It's like it's not gate. Gate was Watergate. Like it was part of the name of the hotel. That was why it was called Watergate. Don't attribute that to anything else.
But I think Gordon. The main problem is that this is a low quality meme created by the old media, and maybe when we finally retire them, these kind of crass words, which have no relevance, will be retired, and we can say something more meaningful. You know, that's just a tired old phrase that they keep using.
Scandal requires two syllables, takes more to say, therefore gate is faster.
I mean, I do agree with you, Gordon. It just seems to me it's one of those, like, it's supposed to be, more hip for people now. It's attention-grabbing. That's why they do it. It's stupid.
Yeah, it definitely is stupid. The whole point of, I don't want to repeat myself, but yeah, the whole point of Watergate, that's the name of the hotel. That was why it was called Watergate. It had nothing to do with water. It was the name of the hotel, it was Watergate. That was the whole point. So just, like, quit it. Like, seriously, quit it. Treat us with some sort of dignity. Just quit it.
It's not possible. You're talking about the mainstream media, Gordian. They can't treat us with any intelligence. They don't have much themselves.
Well, there is that. But yeah, essentially, that's what the pizza, quote, gate, unquote, was all about. The bizarre thing was the news of that, the guy that went into that particular pizza restaurant with a gun. I don't know what quite happened there. Apparently, he held the staff up and demanded access to, behind the scenes, assuming he was going to find some children that he was able to free at gunpoint or something. I don't know quite what happened with that.
The backstory on that's pretty interesting. He actually is an actor.
Also, this was a publicity stunt, was it?
We don't know for sure, but it doesn't look real solid.
Was it Shia LaBeouf acting crazy again?
Yeah. My last update on that, from what I picked up, was it was this guy who read, rightly or wrongly, whatever, he believed that he was doing the right thing, and he went into this pizza restaurant with a gun and demanded access to the sort of the staff only areas, expecting to find underage people that were held as sex slaves and be able to free them. He was trying to do the right thing, albeit from bullshit information. That was my understanding. And then because he went in there with a gun, the cops were called and he was arrested and so on.
So we've just got to hope that Soros and his assistance and funding will shut down the fake news, have we?
Anybody know where I can get the 480 kernel?
Arch Linux.
Your answer to everything is Arch Linux.
I mean, he's not wrong.
It is the right answer.
No, just get in Slackware or Gentoo now, because, yeah.
Gordon.
Funnily enough, on the subject of Arch Linux, it took me so long before I decided, I had tried Arch a long time ago, and I never managed to install it properly. And I thought, you know what, it took me a long, long time, and I thought, you know what, so that I will try Antegros, Antegros, and I could not get it installed. I could not get it, for the life of me, I could not get it installed. And it, again, lack of patience, I thought, you know what, I don't have time for this, I can't be bothered. I'll go back to what I know, which is Ubuntu and Mint and Debian and whatever. And arguably, I'd like to be sitting here with my ThinkPad running Antegros, but I tried. I really tried. I tried, and I could not get it working. It would not install. And I don't know what I did wrong.
It might have just been because once when I installed Antegros, and that's what I use, you know, I've done the manual Arch Linux years ago, and I know how to do it, but for speed, Antegros is just wonderful. It might just be there was one point where they had one of the desktop installations that got messed up, and it wouldn't work for me, and I just downloaded a different version, and it worked fine. I would definitely give it another go, Gordon. I can't believe that you're such low ability that you couldn't manage to follow a few clicks. And if you can get Ubuntu working, if you can use Ubuntu, Antegros is no problem, and you might really like Arch Linux. And also Antegros now allows you to install directly to a ZFS as well. It has ZFS integrated into the installation if you want to try it.
Yeah, and funnily enough, it was the ZFS thing that was the point where, as soon as I heard that was built into the installer, that was the kicker. That was what made me think, you know what, I've really got to give this a go. And Antegros is the first one. Arch Made Easy, yes, that suits me down to the ground. I am not what people think of as a geek. I'm not. I just want things to work. That's why I plump for the easy things. I like it to be customizable, but I want it to just work. I can't be bothered with fussing around trying to figure out how things aren't working. And I figured Antegros is ideal for that. And I tried that. I'll need to try it again. But I tried it once, and the limited time I had at the time, I thought, this is not working for me at all. You know what, I'll go back to what I know, which is the Ubuntu, the Deb side, the Crunchbang, the Debian, the Ubuntu side.
But if anyone's
maybe the installer.
Go ahead, Honky.
I've tried Antegros before, and I've had mixed experience too. And the installer, it's called Cenci, C-E-N-C-I, I believe. It's kind of flaky, I've noticed. And I think I've heard other people talk about it as well, being a little bit flaky. So it sometimes will work, and like Dune Man said, maybe just download a different version of it and give it a shot. But there's also like Manjaro was really good, and I tried a while ago an Arch Builder. I forget the name of it now. If you give me a few minutes, maybe I'll try to look it up. But there's an Arch Builder, which is basically just like a bash script that walks you through step by step, like a straight Arch install.
It's not a difficult thing to follow the scripts either. Just give yourself a good few hours and relax at it. And it's actually quite interesting, and you can just copy and paste. The important thing is just to have two computers next to each other or something, you know. And it's a good learning experience if you enjoy that kind of stuff. And at least you know a bit more how to use your computer, you know. But I wanted to quickly mention, if you're thinking of ZFS, seriously, I was getting really into ZFS. I had, you know, four big disks with a stripe across them, or ZFS, whatever it's called, a Z-pool. But I've actually just ditched it recently, moved over to SnapRaid and MergerFS, if anyone's heard about those. But it's much more flexible for just adding and removing single disks. And if any single disk, or even if multiple disks in the array fuck up, you only lose the data which is on the single disk. It's really fascinating how it works. I'm very impressed by it.
Yeah, I think for me, it was week after week after week of listening to Alan Jude on TechSnap waxing lyrical on ZFS, and thinking at some point, eventually, it was like, it's like, I don't know, it's like the rain that keeps hitting at the top of the teepee. And then eventually, after so long, the rain eventually breaches the fabric of the teepee. It comes through the other side. It's like he's talked so much about ZFS and so how good ZFS is that eventually my brain thinks, you know what, ZFS, I probably should be trying to use that. How can I use ZFS? Like free PCBSD? Yeah, I tried that. Didn't quite work for me because I didn't give enough time. What's the Linux option? Because that's where my familiarity is. And Tergros, right. And that was what tempted me, and it didn't quite work. So I agree with the idea of having like two machines. So one you can sit and work on, and the other you've got able to get online and check through online documentation and things like that and figuring out what commands you need and install and whatever. That definitely helps. The first time I tried Arch, I didn't have that. I just had the one machine, and if I couldn't get it working, I had no choice but to go back to something that I could get it working. Now I've got much more options, and arguably I should be more prepared. It's just a case of having more time to sit and do it, which I've got less of these days.
Just with ZFS, I'm not anti-ZFS at all. I know it really well because I've been using it intensively as just a small home server. You know, I'm not any expert. But just bear in mind, I believe it's for every terabyte of data you need one gig of RAM. I think that's right. And slow down, and there are alternatives for more static data, which is like things like SnapRaid and other stuff like that. And it is a little bit of an overkill for a home, small NAS server, you know, and I perhaps learned that the hard way. It's not cheap if you want to then upgrade a disk pool, because you need to replace all of the disks at the same time. They need to be of an equal size if you want to replace the disks or to create a new pool. And there are more flexible methods, which I've discovered. So that's my only comment or criticism of ZFS. But I use ZFS on root partitions for the snapshotting ability before I do upgrades, which I like.
Might have to start playing with ZFS.
Sorry. So it was called Architect Linux, that thing to be able to, it's just a bunch of scripts basically that'll give you a bare bones Arch system.
Is it Architect and PacBang Linux?
I'm not sure what the PacBang part of it was, and that just kind of showed up. What it's basically, all it is like an ncurses display that kind of walks you through the steps of choosing things for a basic Arch Linux install, and then it does the install, and you're given a bare bones Arch system. I'm not sure what the PacBang was, because you're not given like any sort of desktop environment or anything unless you choose it during that walkthrough install. But yeah, I think that's part of the name.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about, well, I like Arch Linux, but you can export a list of all your packages, and then on any new install, just feed Pacman the list of all your packages, and it'll install them all as previously, you know?
Well, you can do that with Synaptic. I did that occasionally on... For years, I've jumped back and forth between Ubuntu, Debian, Mint, and Crunchbang. And all those cases, you can export that package list as, I believe, it's an XML file. I could be wrong, but I think it's an XML file. And it just tells Synaptic, like, this package is installed, this package isn't installed. And it goes through and changes all that, so you can import that XML file.
I've done that using dpackage dash dash get selections, and then to restore it on a new system, dpackage dash dash set selections, and running the install, sorry, running the apt get with dash dash select. It usually works, except when the repositories between different distributions are different and the package names aren't the same.
Yeah, relying on that, that the package names are the same and that they are in the repos. But beyond that, I mean, that's something I guess you can't really predict. But beyond that, yeah, you're looking at that's an easy way. Or what I used to do was I had a script, just a simple SSH thing. I mean, I'm not a coder by any means at all. I just had a simple text file that sudo apt-get install in the various apps that I used. And anytime I would install a system, I would run that sh space and then that file name, and that would install whatever the apps that I used to have installed before. That was my way around about that. I mean, you are relying on that the repos having those same apps. It might not be the same versions of those apps, but yeah, for the most part, yeah, you're going to have those apps.
The same can happen on Arch Linux, of course. You know, if you leave it too long before you re-import the package, some packages could change names or stuff like that. So I'm sure they're pretty equal, the two systems. I like Arch just because I don't have to remember this new stupid name that Ubuntu comes up with.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I like the idea of Arch. I really do. It's something that there's something about Arch that I'm definitely drawn to. It's the two or three times that I've tried Arch as Arch Linux, like Arch ISO, and I have failed miserably. I have tried Antergros, where I have also failed miserably. It just didn't install. And it's just, I like the idea of Arch, but for some reason Arch has never quite worked for me. It's something that I think honestly, I should be on Arch with KDE. I'm all in on KDE these days. I'm so Plasma. I'm totally Plasma. All my machines are Plasma.
Yeah, you know, I tried Antergos one time, but for some reason, I just could not wrap my head around that. And the first time I tried Manjaro, I couldn't get it installed. The last time I was considering Manjaro, I was thinking LXDE, but they didn't have an LXDE, so I just walked away.
And what was it that didn't make sense? I'm interested. What you couldn't get your head around?
It was just too extremely different from what I was used to.
What, the package installation stuff? Or what part was different? Because surely it's got all the same apps, hasn't it?
No, the menu and everything. The desktop.
Why didn't you pick a desktop which was the same that you used? Because all the desktops are available. You can install anything.
I just couldn't get used to it for some reason.
They do have an LXD version. They have down near the bottom of the download page is one that asks for you can get other desktop environments, and then it's got a big list of like Enlightenment and other non. I don't think they're officially supported. They're like other people are maintaining it. They're not one of the official blends of it, but they are available.
That's just the installation, though. I mean, with Arch or Linux, specifically Arch, you can just install any kind of desktop you want. So, you know, if it's i3, you know, any of those things, you can install. And what I loved about Arch, and I'm not trying to sell Arch here, I just like Arch. I like it because the documentation, the wiki, is very up to date. And if there's anything you want to find out how to do, the Arch wiki, it's always for the current version. And all you've got to do is maintain yourself at the current version, and then the stuff in the Arch Wiki is relevant. Whereas with other stuff, you know, you've got to look, which version of Ubuntu am I using? These are the instructions for that version or this version. To hell with bloody versions. Just give me whatever the current settings are, you know.
Hello, guys.
Hello, MZ.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, what are you guys talking about?
What?
Politics, computers, you name it.
Well, we're all loving on Plasma and KDE. You see the amount of KDE love in this room. It's unbelievable. The Plasma love, we just get off Plasma.
Oh, boy. I thought we were talking about how Trump is going to make America great again, and the whole world.
Well, Plasma and Vice President Hairpiece.
Well, I'm running Corora with the GNOME 3 interface, which I really like.
Yeah, see, the odd thing is, for the last 6 or maybe 7 years, I came to Linux in 2007. with PC Linux OS, which is an offshoot of Mandriva, I think, or Mandrake, possibly. So I came to Linux as KDE from the Windows side. And from then on, I used to think of GTK at that time as being like childish. It's like a toy. It's not a proper computer. And then but after a few years, I tried XFCE, I tried lots of different things, and I came to realize GTK was the business. GTK was like, that's what a proper computer was, particularly XFCE. I loved XFCE. I absolutely adored XFCE.
That was my very first love, is XFCE, but today it's LXDE all the way. Matter of fact, I tried PC Linux OS not too long back, a community LXDE edition, and I almost was able to get used to that, but unfortunately it was too buggy for me.
Yeah, I mean, well, Elliot, that's where I came from, is I kind of fell into the Linux world as GTK, as XFCE, and for me, that was where all of my focus was on. It took me a while to realize that actually GNOME was quite good as well, and other things like GTK and whatever, and that was the time when KDE was going through its whole transition from 3.5 to 4, and it took me a long, long, long time until probably 2 or 3 months ago, where I gave KDE another chance. I'm like, oh my god, where has this been? Like, KDE 5 Plasma is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I had overlooked this for so long. It's amazing. So that's been I've went completely full circle. I'm back to KDE now with no reservations whatsoever. I'm totally KDE now.
Right, let's chat again. Yes, I'm using Gnome 3 at the moment on this laptop. But what I want to say is, that's interesting that actually used PC Linux OS, because I remember whilst I was waiting for an actual Mageia 1 release back in 2010-2011, I thought, I'm going to give PC Linux OS a good try because it's apparently really good, so I put it on the computer, and I was generally very happy with that distro, just everything, just how it works. You've got Synaptic Data, even if it's an RPM distro, the way it looked. I think it was even using GNOME back then as well, not just KDE. What I noticed more recently is that they seem to have dropped GNOME. They have KDE, they have, I think, XFCE and LXDE, but I don't think they do GNOME anymore, which is a shame, because GNOME is actually quite nice. But PC Linux OS, otherwise, is a good distro. It works as far as its early release. It's quite good. It used to be based on Mandrake back in 2003.
Why LXDE over XFCE? I'm interested, Blum. What's the advantage?
Why LXDE or LXQT, maybe? I think
LXDE over XFCE. Rome was saying that she was using LXDE over XFCE. That's her new favourite. I'm just wondering why.
Well, that's not my favourite. But you're saying, why would people use XFCE over LXDE or LXDE over XFCE? They're both, I think they're very, I don't know really, I think they're very similar actually.
In theory. And I stress the words in theory. LXDE is a lightweight desktop environment, whereas XFCE is a medium weight desktop environment.
I think in theory,
I have found that for my personal tastes, XFCE is by far, like by a long, long stretch, that is the best GTK desktop environment that I could possibly go. I love KDE now. I love Plasma 5. All my machines are Plasma 5. If I switch to the other side, to the GTK side, it's XFCE all the way. Absolutely, XFCE, just without, hands down, it's XFCE, and that is a medium weight. It can be lightweight, depends on how it's done. It can be quite heavy, depends on how it's done. But LXD, that's the difference. Generally speaking, XFCE is kind of medium weight, LXDE is lightweight.
Yeah, but I think he was asking me why I would take LXDE over XFCE. And the simple fact is LXDE uses a lot less resources, a lot lighter weight. Plus, I can do anything to it that I can do with XFCE.
Does it do any kind of tiling of windows around, you know, keyboard shortcuts to tile windows into the corners or put them next to each other?
Well, I can theme it, put different icons on it, different wallpapers on it. I can even put a little wallpaper switcher up my panel.
So you can't move windows with keyboard shortcuts to get them to tile in the corners or up on the top or to line up, stuff like that. You can't do that.
Well, I don't really care about that keyboard shortcut stuff. I mean, some of the keyboard shortcuts things are nice, but, you know, just for what the keys are normally meant for.
What I think is, LXDE is probably more lightweight than XFCE. That's probably true, but XFCE can probably do a bit more. But I mean, even Mate or Mate, you know, we're still going to living on. But even that can be pretty lightweight enough. Got my mum's laptop from 2005. Works quite well there. And I only had, 1 gigabyte RAM, 1 gigabyte RAM, but...
Well, Mate is something, or Mate, is something that I would put very much in the same bracket as XFCE. There's not a whole lot of difference in terms of, like, efficiency or whatever. I mean, you could flip a coin and you could judge them either way. I think they're both pretty much about the same. It just depends on what you like to use. I prefer, out of the two of those, I prefer XFCE. I've been used to XFCE. I think XFCE is more customizable, but in terms of resources, yeah, pretty much, you'll flip a coin. One is good as good as the other. In terms of how light XFCE can be, where I think it wins, as if you've got something that's really light and really lean, you can make it as light as it can possibly be. You can put it something like less than, whatever, it's like open box, kind of flux box kind of territory. You can have a whole desktop environment running in such a small amount of RAM that it's unbelievable that nothing else can compare to. You can get a full desktop environment in XFCE running with so little resources that it's unbelievable. I love XFCE, I do. I use KDE now on all machines, but I love XFCE, I really do.
I'm running a... Mate and XFCE being customizable. Again, probably XFCE can actually do more than Mate, really, but there's something about the way you customize it, from what I remember. I never really got on so well with any of that, so I always would go back to GNOME at that time, GNOME 2, or then Mate. But as for things being really lightweight, yeah, I mean, you can take out loads of things and make it really lightweight. Although, yeah, OpenBox, from when I've tried, all it really is, you know, it's just the back screen. And there's not even the background. You right click, you've got a right click menu, and that's about it.
That's the advantage. See, you're seeing that as a downside. I'll argue that.
Well, I don't see it as a downside. I see it as, well, that is very, very, very basic. Like the most basic thing there is, pretty much, which can be okay. If you want to quickly load up a program, that's it.
There's my man running open box. There's APG running open box. There's my man. I'll defend open box. I love Crunchbang. I absolutely love Crunchbang. It's no longer, but I love Crunchbang.
Yeah.
Open box is brilliant.
There were two people at my Linux user group who used to be Goad who were all into Crunchbang. Plus, I've been at Old Camp, so I've been there with the guy who made Crunch Bang, stuff like that. But I just remember the people before that, and they were like, oh, open box, Crunch Bang. And then you try open box that yourself, and you realize, oh, it's all it is well, what I just said. But that's fine. I mean, even that, if you want to quickly get into the program, that and that's it, you don't care about the graphical effects and eye candy and all that kind of stuff, then it's and that's kind of all you need, really. You see the menu, you see the way to open the program.
Well, that's the whole point of OpenBox, is it is so light with, in terms of CrunchBang, it was the tint menu, which was super lightweight in terms of RAM. There's nothing to it at all. That's your taskbar. And then there's no possible way to add any menus onto the desktop at all, which I love. I refuse to have any icons at all on my desktop. Doesn't matter what environment. I'm using Plasma at the moment. I have no menus at all, no icons at all on my desktop. I will not have that on my desktop. That's with OpenBox. It doesn't allow you to do that. You need to go out of your way to actually have icons on your desktop. You update the menu items yourself, so it's customizable, but it's sort of forced. But in that way, I love OpenBox. I really love OpenBox. It's like it forces you to be manual, but it's so good. It is really so good. I love OpenBox. I really love OpenBox.
See, I have OpenBox just because, one, I don't want icons. Two, like to really like change anything, it's just open a config file, put whatever you want in it, go for it. Also, I really just don't need GNOME getting in my way. Generally, when I'm on the desktop, which I am now for this, but I'm generally only using a web browser, Darktable, or the GIMP. That's pretty much it.
Oh, we got somebody else new here. KDG, he's from Jupiter Broadcasting, and MZ was from Open Linux Community, and I'm from Open Linux Community.
Willkommen.
What is the Open Linux Community?
Oh, it's another Linux channel, just like Jupiter Broadcasting and just like Tux Bytes Linux.
Yeah, for one of the things, when I came to computing in like 2002, maybe 2003, I came with Windows XP, and I absolutely hated the fact that any time you install a program, it would throw an icon on the desktop. I hated that. With it was like, oh, that's grated on me so much. And when I came to Linux, I wanted the ability to control that. And every desktop environment let me, they didn't automatically install that, whether it was GNOME 2 or XFCE or LXDE or KDE, whatever it is, they didn't automatically add that onto the desktop. So the fact that any desktop or any window manager that explicitly didn't have that functionality, that you could not put an icon on the desktop, that was almost, it was like, almost like a reaction to that I think, like OpenBox, it doesn't have the ability to put a shortcut on the desktop. That almost, it was, I sort of treated that like with a feature, not like something that was lacking, where other people, if they're used to that and they want the desktop on the icon on the desktop, they see that as something that's missing. But I see that as a feature, not.
I agree with you 100%. I think icons all over your desktop looks like shit, you know? The only place my icons belong is in the menu or on the panel or in the plank type thing.
Yeah, I mean, cloud Windows desktops with icons, but you can see Windows screenshots all over the internet, for example, and all these desktop icons everywhere. And there'll be Firefox and certain common programs, but it's not about the programs, it's about the icon, you know, all these icons everywhere. But take something like, well, KDE always did put icons there, or not, well, there would be for computer and the trash can, not so much for programs, but there'll be a few icons there for that. But something like GNOME 3, on the other hand, that's always been about, well, there are no icons that on the desktop. It's they weren't clean in that kind of sense.
Yeah, for me, I mean, for a lot of people, that's I'm on the opposite side of a lot of people. The whole point of the whole Microsoft thing of calling it a shortcut is the idea of your brain can think, I want to access X, therefore I'll click on X. It's easy to see, therefore I can click on it and it can launch quicker. That's the whole point. So when it comes to, you know, when you clutter up the desktop, when you clutter up the menu, it basically means that you're slowing down the time it takes for you to recognize what it is you're looking to click onto to actually start the program. And that's in part why I like my desktop for, I don't think I've ever seen, apart from a basic install, where I've yet to get the chance to spend the 2 or 3 seconds and get into the menu and removing it. I don't think I've seen an icon on my desktop for a good 7 or 8 years. Possibly, not other than the stuff at work, but I have no control over that. I've got to just accept that, which is annoying the shit out of me, but I've got to just accept it. It's how it goes. My own machines, where I can have control over, there's nothing will ever be on the desktop of my computers. Doesn't matter what environment I'm running, what desktop environment I'm running, what window manager, I don't care. I'm never going to have icons on my desktop. It's just
Another one is, more Windows, I guess, really, but, you know, some people don't really save documents in the My Documents folder or the equivalent, if it's Linux, I suppose. And, you know, they end up with documents on their desktop as well, not just icons, but actual files, which isn't that good either, really.
Yeah, for me, at work, I just get around that by maximising all of the programs that I need. So I never actually see the desktop where I'm working. And, yeah, that's my only way around about it. All of my controls outside of that is locked down by the administrator. Like, oh, God damn it, you've got to be kidding me. Like, seriously? You mean we've got to put up with this shit? Okay, fair enough. Yeah, my whole point of that was the idea that any window manager or desktop environment that gives you control and gives a nice clean desktop is something that I'm interested in. As soon as you start having sort of automatic assumptions and that you've got to build that desktop into something that has icons on it, but that becomes a deal breaker for me. I don't want any icons at all, like zero icons on my desktop. Anything more than zero is too many.
How do you feel about background information, like Conkey or something like that?
So run that past me again?
A background information, processes and stuff running, similar to what Conkey does to provide you a heads-up display on the desktop about the processes that are going on the computer.
Oh, Conkey, yeah, that was one of the things that's quite possibly the first thing that I remove, or that I used to remove on CrunchBank. And it has Conkey. I don't want that either. I just want a plain desktop. I mean, granted, that has valuable information on it, but that's one of the things I go into the setup, the OpenBox. Well, when I used to run CrunchBank, I would go into the OpenBox thing and stop Conkey running by default as soon as it starts. And then go in and remove the .conkey RC file with the information on that, because that doesn't interest me either. I just want a plain desktop.
Now, forgive my possible ignorance, but I don't necessarily see the purpose of seeing what my CPU usage is, and I mean, I can see what like running programs there are, or you know, I can't see what the purpose of like seeing how much RAM I'm using at that moment, what that's going to do for me. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe that's just me.
My problem with something like that is you kind of start to obsess over it. Like you'll be going, oh man, look at what like the GIMP is using. I'm using like 100% of like two cores or something. And then you go, well, look how much RAM it's using. Well, why is this using so much RAM? Why is this using so much process? And then you just kind of, it's a downward like shame spiral. But really the only things I have going with OpenBox is Fe for a wallpaper and the Tint 2 panel.
Yeah. I'm the same. I just stopped checking any bank statements or checking to see what my wife spent at all because I started to kind of get paranoid about how much money was being spent, and I thought it was much better not to focus on where all the resources were going, you know, and it was much better to be in ignorance.
They're kind of just the opposite. If I'm doing multiple things on the computer at the same time, for example, right now I've got the Mumble screen open, but I'm also editing a bunch of websites at the same time. And I'd like to know when I've reached the limit of the resources on the computer so that I can back on something. There's a couple of downloads going on. I'm torrenting the Chaos Computer Club video files at the same time. So if things aren't working well, I'd like to know where they're not working well. And the panel displays, I'm using Mate with the system monitor applet, temperature applet, and CPU frequency applet in the top bar. And when things go wrong, I can see that at a glance and turn things off that I'm not needing at that particular time.
Is that not really... the way I look at it is, if you're coming across the limits of what your capability can do, like your bandwidth, your computer, whatever it is, if you're coming across the limits of what it can do, then it becomes relevant. But unless you're reaching those limits, then it doesn't matter. If you're talking about the GIMP using 100% of your CPU, as long as it's not impacting you when you're moving the cursor around, when you're changing programs, when you're changing windows, when you're changing different things, and you're clicking on different things, as long as it doesn't slow you down, as long as it doesn't be a delay on different click on things and it gives a delay on action, or as long as it doesn't impact you, then what does it matter the fact that it's taken 98% of your CPU or 98% of your RAM or whatever? It doesn't matter. Surely it doesn't matter because it's still doing the same things and getting the same results.
Well, what matters is thermal output, battery usage. You know, I don't care if something takes all the CPU, but if it's going to kill my battery or overheat my machine in the process, then yeah, now I have a problem. Otherwise, I don't care.
The other thing, if I do hit a limit, I don't want to have to start bringing up the various tools to tell me what might be wrong. I want to be able to see what's wrong at the time that it's going wrong. And I work in pretty much the opposite thing. As long as I haven't reached the maximum resources yet, I'm always contemplating, you know, what else could the computer be doing at the same time that, you know, I don't need to pay direct attention to, but that could run as a background process. So as long as I see that there's still resources available, I can optimize the use of the computer that I'm running. I'd rather have one computer that's maxed out than having three or four computers sitting around there, you know, idling at 30% or so.
Stuff. Bob, you, sir, are using your computer to its maximum, and that's awesome. Second off, I just wanted to point out that I've heard people, what bothers me is I hear a lot of people in the past talk about, you know, how they get nervous when they see they have like a 16 gigs of RAM, and they get nervous when they see like four are being used. Or, you know, they have like so much CPU processors that are never being touched before. And that bugs me. You know, why worry about it if you have such a powerful machine? Why worry about what little you're actually using of it? And then you have people like Bob here who's just pushing this one machine to its brink, and I think that's awesome.
Say, did you guys see those last two screenshots I put in the box?
I see them.
Just have to go and have a look. Give me a second.
Hello, Zimba.
How you doing, KDG?
I've never seen you in here before.
Oh, I've been in here a few times before.
It's maybe not the new year where you are.
No, it's not. It's 5:58 p.m. It's not midnight yet. And does anybody know where I can get 481 stable kernel?
I can have a look at GX Self's free kernel, see what level that's at. That might do the trick for you. Don't have a link at the top, at the fingertips, though.
I'm looking on Launchpad right now. I see a lot of things that's talking about it, but I don't see it there.
What do you need that kernel for?
Because they said that that particular kernel had a lot of audio issues fixed.
And you've got audio problems?
Yes, I have no audio whatsoever from the built-in speakers. Right now I'm using plug-in speakers.
What distro are you using?
Black Lab Linux LXDE. Oh, I put two screenshots in the box. You can take a look at it.
Yeah, I saw those already. Arch Linux is still the best.
Well, I really wish that Manjaro had an LXDE.
But it does. Of course it does. I mean, you guys, we've all got to stop thinking that just the default installs of a desktop that comes with some Arch Linux easy install is all you can have. It's literally one Pac-Man command from the away. It's so simple.
Well, I know Siva told me that Manjaro's got an LXDE. I says, no, they don't. I says, I clicked on the thing that says community, and I didn't see one there.
I mean, for example, if you install XFCE, I'll write the command here in the prompt where you've got to type, and that's all you've got to do.
You know, I think that's a little bit of a kind of a talking point, really, is the fact that, for me, I've got into, over the last 6 months or so, I've got into KDE. So I'm looking at what distros can I try that I've got a good KDE implementation. Now, you can replace KDE with whatever, you know, GNOME 3 or Unity or XFCE, whatever you want. Now, isn't that a concern where you're looking at, what can I choose? What distro do I want, but what environment do I want? Like, and I mean, surely this is probably the time I started getting into Linux, where you would pick your distribution and the distribution, the installer had a choice of XFCE or KDE or GTK or whatever it was. It seems like you need to have, it's a kind of specialized thing. If I like LXDE, I want to pick a distro that's kind of specialized in LXDE and get a specific spin of that distro that has LXDE on it. Do you not think that's a kind of like a backwards step?
You've got to separate two things. You know, you've got the default kind of configuration of the desktop, and then you've got the pre-configured or pre-chosen apps. And I think people get hung up about choosing apps which are all GDK or GNOME apps. Personally, just like to use the apps that I like to use, whether GTK, GNOME, KDE apps, you know, it doesn't matter. And then pick the desktop I like, you know. But you do have a point, you know, some KDE distros, the default installation of the KDE itself, you know, just desktop, it's got a more nicely, more appropriately configured desktop, you know.
I'm like that as well. I would use Qt or GZK, I'd use KDE, GNOME, whatever. I don't really care as long as the apps program work. But Fizzle Web has a point there that how certain distros are, well, you get a default interface, or I was like, let's, for example, Mozilla has GNOME and KDE as the two most supported default interfaces. You can get XFCE and Mate and other ones, either the custom installer or via repos. Fedora has GNOME as its default interface, but you can also have a KDE version, you can have an XFCE version. Ubuntu has Unity, which is now their interface by default. There's other flavors there as well, Kubuntu, Ubuntu and all that. OpenSUSE is, well, I think it's actually really both GNOME and KDE and pretty much the same in that sense. But certain distributions have more of a reputation of being better for one of those interfaces than the other. So Fedora is known as a good GNOME distro. Mozilla is known as a good KDE distro, more so than a GNOME distro, probably, really. OpenSUSE has a kind of being a good KDE distro reputation. PC Linux OS is mostly a KDE distribution. OpenMandriva, I was looking at that again the other day on the website or whatever, and again, they seem to just be doing nothing but KDE there now, really. So again, OpenMandriva is a good KDE one, and so it goes on. But generally in the past or now, even now, you pick a distro and you get web interface, you get by default, and then you go from there, which is sort of what Thistle Web was kind of getting at as well.
Well, this is exactly my point. When you're saying about things like, I mean, I agree with you when it comes to Mandriva was a good, it was known as KDE, and Fedora is known as GNOME or whatever, and SUSE is known, or OpenSUSE is known as KDE, and that's my point, is the fact that isn't the whole power of Linux the fact that it's this core at the center of everything, and then you can tack on whatever environment you prefer, and it's going to be equally good. It's like you attack on Foxbox or OpenBox or, you know, XFCE, LXCE, KDE, whatever it is you want, you tack it on as an add-on to the kernel, so an add-on to the basics of what Linux is. So the fact that OpenSUSE has there, you can go to their download page and see the GNOME 3 version, ISO, you download that. Or the KDE version, you download that. Or the XFCE version, you download that. That's my point, is the fact that these are so different. It's like, surely that's a concern. Like, what happened to that? What happened to that ideal where you could have the same basic and then you tag on whatever it is? What's the point of an ISO for GTK? Or ISO for KDE, an ISO for XFCE, or whatever. What's the point of that? Surely that's kind of counterproductive.
Ubuntu maybe kind of do it still, sort of, what you're getting at or not, but you know, you have the Ubuntu base, and then you go for whatever interface, so Kubuntu, or Ubuntu. But yeah, generally, any of these interfaces should work in whatever distro you chose that's a sports interface, and it should all be pretty much the same.
Say, does anybody know if kernel.org is a legitimate site?
I think that's the upstream site for the kernel, isn't it?
I hope so.
You think it is? Anyhow, Gordon, I did put two links in the box for you. They're way up high. You have to scroll back up to find them. But there's one for the Crunchbang tips, tricks, and scripts, and another one for LX Linux.
Yeah, that tips and links thing, I have that as one of every time that I had had installed Crunchbang, I jumped back and forth between it was all Debian side, so it was Crunchbang, Debian, Ubuntu, and Mint. It was one of those four I would run on everything, absolutely everything. And most of the time, my preference would be Crunchbang because it was nice and light and it was open box. And one of the first things I would do was always look at the Crunchbang forums and to find ways to sort of trick out like open box. So I have seen that before in terms of open box.
Yeah, that particular page is for OpenBox, but I know he's got a page around someplace for LXDE, tips, tricks, and stuff, and scripts and stuff. Now, I would say on that one, the LX Linux one, he did just update something on it this month. But do be careful. There's certain things that's kind of old on the site that might not mix very well with the new distro, and do not use the LX Med he's talking about on the site. Do not use it. too many people lost their menus after just installing it.
Did it work installing it to come menu back then?
I installed it, I opened it up, I took a look at it, I didn't really even do anything, I didn't activate anything on it. I closed it up, and all of a sudden I noticed my menu was gone. It was just gone, you know? And I'm thinking, what the hell? I didn't click on anything in there. The only thing I did was, all I did was open it up and look at it, you know, and scroll up and down and look at what was in there. And I clicked on the red X, just close it up. And then, boom, my menu is gone.
Was it possible to get the menu back again?
Oh, I eventually got it back. It took me from 9 o'clock in the morning to about 9 o'clock at night, and I finally found a command that did it for me.
Yeah. You maybe get the hint of the... So you, if you can make a comment on the site, you maybe help someone out then.
Yeah, well, you'll have no idea how pissed off I was. I was about 1 minute from actually reinstalling the entire operating system.
Well, as they say, better to be pissed off than pissed on.
There's a motivation for learning how your computer works, you know, learning what packages install and how to fix stuff. And I know it might seem painful, but sometimes getting to grips with something like Arch Linux, you know, and understanding how and what packages do when you install them is not a bad idea.
Yeah, that's why I started with Slackware. I really just wanted to get my hands dirty at the whole process and learn as much as I could there.
Slackware was actually my first distro. I mean, when we're back in the days when you had to install it with floppy disks.
Oh, that's how I got my menu back. I put that command in the terminal and restarted the computer, and boom, it was back.
I'm not as old school as having to do it with floppies, but I've been a Linux user since 2005, and back then it was, I think it was 4 CDs going through all that.
Yeah, 2004 for me when I started off with Fedora Core 2, couldn't get online. Anyway, yeah, it was like four CDs, and it's like 4 hours to install as well. And then, of course, Grub goes wrong, and then you don't know what to do because you're newbie, and you reinstall with the later version and all this.
Forget all of that. Linux from scratch. That's what I'm doing next.
Or, what was the, what was it? I think it was called Suicide Linux or something like that.
Oh, was that the one where if you're writing the wrong command or something like that, it gradually counts down, it gradually deletes things as you're going along? Suicide Linux?
I thought I just did like an RM on the entire file system.
Yeah, it could be.
Maybe there's a package you can even get for Ubuntu that would do that for you, you know, help you learn quicker.
Yeah, for me, there's a few basic things. I mean, I am forced to use Windows at work, which most people are familiar with. They hate it, and Linux is there. When they get home, that is their kind of savior, the fact that they've spent 8.5 hours or whatever it is in front of a really frustrating Windows computer, and then at least when they get home, they've got something sane that they can use. But a few of the things, like the idea of Windows always having a window on top and having a window on top of other windows, that would save me so much time at work. But I'm on Windows, I don't have that option. If I was just using Linux, that would make my life so much easier. That's one thing. The idea of being able to right click anywhere on the desktop, anywhere on the screen, and having the application menu pop up underneath my pointer, that would save me so much time as well, rather than having to all the way down to the start menu and then clicking and all the way up. That would save me so much time. It just minor differences make all the difference.
There are some tools under Windows that'll make those things happen. Third-party tools, possibly some shady tools. Depends on how much control you've got over your own PC at work.
Yeah, there is that, but that comes down to an IT department that are very, very conservative. It's like, no, we're not doing anything that's even remotely unorthodox. Like, no, we're not having that. It's like, oh, you've got to be kidding me, there's a better way to do it than this. Like, seriously, trust me, there's a better way to do it. But no, it's not happening at all.
As a system administrator myself, I can appreciate that view.
One of the things that drives me craziest with Windows is on Linux, if your mouse cursor is over a window, any window, if it's, you know, an activated window or not, if you scroll, it'll scroll that window. On Windows, it'll only scroll the window that's on top.
Oh, that's so handy in Linux. That is something that for the past, well, this is 26, this is the final day of 2016, like 45 minutes into, like, that I've had this for so long. That is such a good thing. And on Windows, like, no, that drives me nuts. That's absolutely insane, the fact that you've got to click into that window to make it active before you can scroll it. It's like, why? Like, seriously, why? That's bizarre. That's utterly bizarre. That should not be. We need to find a way around that. That's bizarre.
I mean, I know, yeah. in my brain, it's only, you know, one simple quick click and I'm ready to scroll in another window. But getting used to doing that again, it's taking minutes off of whatever task I could be doing.
I know it's just a workflow thing for me, but I miss multiple desktops. I can't tell you how many times I'll just put something like a full page of something on one desktop and then just keep on scrolling back and forth between different desktops just to get one thing done. And not having that in Windows just drives me nuts.
Yeah, that's something that if I had, I mean, I need to use Windows 7 at work. If I had that option, that my workflow would be so much easier. Each day, every minute I'm working there, I'm thinking how easier this would be, how much less stressful this would be with any version of Linux. I don't care what it is. Any version of Linux, any desktop environment with multiple desktops and the always on top thing, and, you know, pointer follows cursor type thing, all of those things would seriously improve my workflow and reduce my stress. But no, I'm working on Windows. I've got limited options. I've got to work on Windows, and that's Windows 7.
Like you said, it's a workflow thing, and generally on my desktop, I'll have Darktable on one desktop, GIMP on another, a full screen terminal on another, and then I'll just have another one free for whatever. Like, sometimes I'll use more virtual desktops, sometimes I'll use less, you know. So I'm usually rocking between 4 to 6. And for me personally, having something full screen, you know, whatever I'm working in on one desktop, kind of forces me to stay and keep working and not get distracted going, oh, you know, I thought about this one YouTube video, I'm going to watch that real quick. And then, you know, that goes down the YouTube hole. But if I have it full screen on one desktop and I can keep just switching between whatever I'm actually working on, I get so much done so quickly.
You know, I think that's the three, arguably, the killer features of Linux, or arguably BSD as well, although I'm not sure, is the three killer things that Windows just cannot possibly compete with. A, virtual desktops. As soon as you get to wrap your head around the idea of virtual desktops and what it can do and how you can improve your workflow with virtual desktops.
I have to kind of interrupt you with that one, because as of Windows 10, there's actually virtual desktops, which I don't know if you've tried that for yourself or not.
Well, yeah, that's true. That is absolutely true. However, up until Windows 10, this was something that Microsoft never did. So they've gotten people inclined to run Windows all on the same desktop. The whole virtual, the whole multiple desktops thing, totally new. So people who are aware of that, great. That's fine. They've got used to that. They've been introduced to that. The whole point of virtual desktops is a fantastic idea. Once you wrap your head around the idea, and it does take time, and you can adapt your workflow to that, it's great. The other thing is, the as I said, the right click on anywhere on the desktop and it brings up the menu. That's a fantastic thing as well. These are things that it takes time to wrap your head around. But once you do, it's something you don't really want to give up. The other thing is the always on top. It's such a minor thing, but the idea of having been able to set one window, like a text document or something, as always on top, and then you scroll like the document underneath it to copy and paste, that's unbelievable. As a workflow thing, that's unbelievable. It's something that people who haven't experienced that don't understand how functional that is. But when they do, you know, they don't want to give that up, and that's where Linux comes in by default.
I love that always on top. There's like one text file that I use for when I'm posting stuff for the Linux Lugcast into archive.org. When you go through the initial stuff.
You're quite late.
Oh, sorry. I think my thumb was over the mic here. I said always on top is an excellent feature. There's like one text file that I use every time I post Linux Lugcast episodes into archive.org that I just kind of copy and paste. And it's every single time I just have that thing, that one text file, always on top, and then just being able to copy and paste from that one text file into the web page. It's a beautiful thing, and you can't get that anywhere else.
Tell you, always on, you've no idea how I would kill for always on top to be available in my workplace. There's so many times I would love almost always on top, but it's Windows. It's Windows 7, and it's not an option. I would love always on top. Always on top is phenomenally good. It's such a simple idea, but it's so functional. It's really so functional.
There's a small thing you want.
That's one thing I want, yes. It's the one thing I want, ideally, in Linux. I want to be able to go into work and log into a Linux machine, but that's not likely to happen. So I'm taking the minor victories where I can get them. And the minor victories, the most important thing, arguably, that I could use would be always on top. I love always on top. It's something that I use at home on the own machines. And when I'm at work, I'm like, why am I working on such a backwards ass machine? Like, surely this has
got to talking to you, man. You absolutely got to check on that link right now. Every single bit of that is LXDE desktops, and all the rest is what I did to my browser.
One of the things I constantly find myself wanting when I'm working on Windows is to just open a terminal and install something. Constantly having to go through wizards and all that crap drives me nuts. Because generally I'm like, oh, I need to install this to get whatever work I need done. If I was doing it on Linux, then I would just open a terminal, type it in, bam, done. On Windows, clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, Windows definitely likes its installers, and that is a good thing with Linux. Is generally you just download it from the repos or whatever, and that's that. Although we do have the occasional program with an install as well, though they tend to be proprietary software, I think actually, or like a license agreement or something you got to set or something like that,
So anyhow, I think it's amazing what you could do with LXDE.
Okay, let's have a look at your image, which is the bottom link, actually. Let's have a look.
Have you tried the new thing Qt? LXQT?
I am not even interested in LXQT.
I tried it. It was very less comfortable. You can talk.
Okay, that looks nice, although I would still stick to, personally, to Canadian Fury or Unity 8 or maybe even Unity 7 or Mate.
But isn't it amazing what you could do with LXDE?
Well, yeah, you've done a lot of, well, it looks quite nice, the image, yeah.
Yeah, all the rest of them is how I send my browser. Oh, and by the way, I even know how to install Comp is in LXDE, and Spatry said it couldn't be done.
I think, I haven't really thought of it, but it would make sense that that should work as well, because it's GTK based, isn't it? I mean, the old Unity 7 was using Compass via GTK, so should work with XFCE as well. It used to work with KD, actually, Compass. I remember playing that with, can't remember the cube effects with KD in the past, and obviously GNOME 2 as well. So it should work, I think, with everything GTK or well with the Forza.
Yeah, well, many years ago when I met Spatry, he said that you could not install Comp as an LXDE. Well, I proved him wrong. And there's another person I proved wrong, too, is, what's the name of that guy? Rotten Corpse. He told me that I would never be able to get my my handheld controller to work with my laptop because I had a, what's it, PC, let me find out the name of this program, PCSXR. It's a PlayStation emulator, and I had some games on it. All I had to do is get my handheld controller to work on it. Well, Rotten Corpse said I would never be able to do it, but I proved him wrong.
I remember I've installed like a PlayStation emulator, possibly the same program in the past as well, and then you get a game running or something, and you put your PlayStation disc in, and then you realize, oh, I don't have the hardware for this, but. Or something like that, as a controller or whatever the computer would actually need. But now I've actually got a nice, portable gaming devices where you can play all these old games, and you've got the hardware and all the rest of it, so that's good. And they're quite small devices.
Yeah, that greenish and sunny yellow theme, I stole that from Bodhi.
That's really naughty. I'm gonna have to tell them that, but I'm joking with you. I remember I stole I didn't really steal, but from the Madea 5 artwork contest, I remember there was like a really nice sunset image that I'm involved with Madea as well on the community stuff, so but I took the image and I put it on in my Ubuntu tab and I've had that as my background for many months now, but that wasn't quite the intention of that image. The person who submitted that, they wanted it in to Madea as a screensaver, not really to appear on the Ubuntu tablet, but oh well.
Yeah, if you see that blue one with the ducks flying in front of the moon, to the right in the corner you'll see a little elegant conky, and to the left you'll see like a little panel thing. I stole those both from LXLE.
Well, some images, to be fair, you know, it's perfectly okay, really. How are they licensed? Is it in the Creative Commons? You're allowed to share it? Are you allowed to use it like that? You know, but I know what you're generally saying, taking it off something else and then you're using it in that. But
yeah,
generally, if images are under a free to share thing or whatever, then, you know, it's fine, really.
Yeah, and the one you see with the huge orange flower and the really dark theme, I got that stuff from Noob's Lab. Oh, I didn't get the wallpaper from Noob's Lab. I got everything else from them.
Maybe they can put your link in the show notes, because anyone listening to this later on might know what we're talking about.
On that real greenish one with the great big lake, if you see the icons top left, I believe those are called the Crunch icons or something. I got those from Noob's Lab as well. Oh, they're called Cluster. I'm sorry.
I haven't really customized a desktop for ages. I haven't really needed to. I like defaults.
Boring looking kind of thing.
And that real metallic one that looks like something that came out of the Matrix almost. I stole that stuff from Linux Mint. Oh, and the one below that with those really cool looking icons. I stole those icons from, Makulu. Oh, what's the name of that robot in Iron Man?
You mean Iron Man?
Yeah, Iron Man. Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. What's the name of the robot in there? The computer.
Jarvis.
Oh yeah, Jarvis. That's it. If you could take a look at the blue one, the bluish theme, I got that theme from a guy that actually created a real Jarvis on his computer.
Sorry, I'm just here. I'll put Molotov on the background. I can hear them.
You're coming and going.
You gotta admit, there's some gorgeous desktops.
All your work paid off, Simba.
Do what?
All your work paid off. You was learning how to do this kind of stuff last time we talked.
Oh, I learned all that stuff about 3 years ago or more.
Maybe you were still chasing some other desktop then.
Yeah, I got my kernel. I just got to figure out how to install the damn thing.
No easy way. It's just typing a command in and that's it. Is your distro based on Ubuntu or something else?
Debian Ubuntu.
So it uses deb files then?
Yes, it uses deb files, and I got Synaptic Package Manager and a software center.
Yeah, Synaptic Package Manager is my favorite application to do a packing kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the name of my file. I just got to figure out how to install the damn thing. I think I know, but I'm not exactly sure.
The other guy send give you a link how to you can compile it.
Egads, I don't want to do that.
You're gonna have to.
You maybe need that other file, maybe a deb file on the Victory kernel.
No. I've got it in this package right here. I'm extracting it right now. I just need to figure out how to install it from here going forward.
If you have a .deb file, I would install it by using dpkg --i, and then the package name, which will do the installation of the deb package.
I thought that I just went into the terminal and did something like sudo apt-get install, and then just put the path name.
I think apt-get will version of a deb package, dpkg --i. Then usually I follow it up with an apt-get --install --f, which fixes up any missing dependencies that that package might demand.
Wouldn't I do it that way? See, sudo apt-get install, and then the path?
Apt-get install usually wants the name of a package, not an actual package in a file name itself. What apt-get will then do is download the package from the repositories. So I don't think you want to supply a path to a deb file using apt-get install.
No, I do not have a deb file. I got a tar.xz file, and I just open it up and got a little folder out of it that says Linux 4815.
And what is inside that one? You may be downloading the source code.
Oh, there's a bunch of folders and files in here.
Yeah. You downloaded the source code of the kernel. You what you want is the deb file of the source code.
Well, can't I get a freaking PPA or something that's easy? I mean, does everything got to be so freaking hard on me?
See and go out and see if you can find a deb file for it.
Okay, I'll try that. Okay, I went to Google and I typed in download Ubuntu kernel stable 4815.deb.
Did you get something? Welcome back, dude.
Oh, have you guys ever heard of a kernel with the name Licorex?
There's a link in the mumble chat that will walk you through all of that there.
You get the files in there, I see.
Oh, I see the page.
There you can find the deb file for whatever you need. Mr. Beckley.
Wait a minute, that's the same site that I just found.
Is it funny? Maybe many people have googled it today.
Yeah, there you go.
Always hard to pronounce new name.
Yeah, a lot of people have trouble with it, especially telemarketers. So generally, if someone calls me and I don't know the number, and they're like, Mr. Weaverly? I'm like, nope, goodbye.
What distro do you got?
I run Fedora.
With GNOME then?
No, I use OpenBox.
That may be not default. So it's not yourself then.
I can't hardly understand. You're breaking up awful bad.
Did you open it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Did you install it from source or from market?
I just installed it from an RPO. I mean, I didn't really see any advantage of just compiling OpenBox myself.
I feel it's harder to compile if it's many dependencies.
I mean, it's not like it would take long, considering OpenBox itself is like 1.4 megs or something like that. I mean, you could still pretty much fit OpenBox on a floppy disk.
Oh, have you tried that?
No, I haven't. But one of these days, I'm going to get me like a really old computer and just find something that'll go on it just to do it.
Yeah, I computers have a disk drive. I was searching over the web and trying to find a distro who fit into a floppy disk. I didn't find any. All the time, each time I...
Yeah, I was trying to figure out the difference in between those three things. Well, I finally found out the difference. The first one is Linux headers. The second one is Linux image. The third one is a kernel that is not generic. The first two are generic.
Mr. Riley, are my voice going in and out all the time?
Yes.
They're still firing up stuff where I am. Maybe that's why.
So anyhow, I would start by opening up the terminal and putting this in, right?
Right. Nearly New Year here, so I'll be going away from this for a while soon.
Bye.
Who's on this anyway, still? Who's on this still?
I'm still here.
I'm still here.
I'm still here, but slightly distracted with all the work that I'm doing.
Yeah, we lost Gordon, I think. Well, he's still in the channel, but in the thing, but not all, I don't think. But anyway, yeah, I'll be back a bit later. Back a bit later.
Have a good sleep then.
Wait, what was that?
If I have a good sleep.
No, I'm not going to. It's just New Year stuff, and then I'll come back for a bit on this.
Oh.
11, yeah, about 12 minutes to go, plus the extra second. There's an extra second this year.
Yeah, I heard about that.
I just saw something in the terminal go by me. It says, possible missing firmware.
That doesn't sound good.
That is very likely has identified the speakers, your sound card, and recognizes that there are no free and open source drivers available for it.
Mr. Dierley.
Be right back.
See you. Can someone hear if I'm still chirpy?
Well, I can still hear you, and you're not breaking up anymore, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, I did go on the speed. I did go on this page and try to find out if my web was wrong, and the first time I tried is just stopped, and I got timeout error.
But it sounds fine, so, you know, speed test notwithstanding, the sound is good.
Yeah, so it's maybe a very little low, too many BIOSes in the same time, maybe, and I get very low, no idea why.
And having just said that, what you just finished saying was broken up again, so maybe it isn't so good after all.
Yeah. I'm not sure I can fix it, because I think it's something with my web.
Very likely it's something upstream from you that you have no control over.
Yeah, exactly. And I hate it. And it must be the day I can talk to people. Normally, it's not very many people in here.
I know, this is quite the party we're having.
I didn't know about it, I was just lucky and come in here a day before it was going on.
I feel like a bit of an imposter. I popped in yesterday just as it was getting set up, and I'm actually not a Hacker Public Radio contributor yet, although I've promised Ken Fowler that I would actually get that fixed, so that there should be a podcast of mine coming out as soon as I get around to recording one.
So, dost you listen to it, or your first time joining this place?
Oh, no, I've been listening to Hacker Public Radio for well over a year now, so you know, it's high time that I paid my way.
I cannot really speak. I have never listened to it.
It's fascinating. There's all manner of things. At our Software Freedom Day, we issued a free culture disc, which had some podcasts on it, and I recommended two from Hacker Public Radio. The request was to have podcasts that weren't of a technical nature. So I suggested two episodes, one called How to Smoke a Pipe, and another one, How to Skin a Snake, which are about as untechnical as I could think, but, you know, still some fascination to the people who consider themselves part of the hacker crowd. And that was 2 years ago, actually. That was the last time that we had a Software Freedom Day in Kitchener. That would have been 2014.
You can see my result. It's no way it needs to be so shoppy as it is. And I cannot hear my shoppiness.
Oh my, you have considerably more capacity than I have on mine. I get about 30 megabits per second download, and I think 5 megabits per second upload. Yet mine sounds fine. I'm also running some torrents in the background, the video that I'm downloading from the Chaos Computer Conference. Phone, VoIP is running, who knows what else is going on. So I'm surprised that you're getting as poor quality as of sound as you're getting.
Yeah, I think it's a middleman, something in between, something I have no control of. I think I'll go to top speed, no speed, kind of thing.
Well, that could be.
I try to go on the website. It's totally waiting on one of the links some of you send me. And the next time I try it, it just take 1 second.
Who knows? You'll have to go and hunt down whatever bit of fiber is you know, not connected properly. Like I said, I'm likely something that you'll be able to fix yourself. And it's unlikely that you'll get any technicians at your ISP to fix it on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, the wrong day in the year to get someone to fix that.
Exactly.
Especially it's night here. It's over midnight and no one goes to fix that before tomorrow.
Everybody else is celebrating today too.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm from Elmira, which is in Ontario, Canada, just about an hour west of Toronto in Canada.
Oh, so it's not yet New Year for you?
Our local time here is 1900 hours in the evening, or 3 minutes before 1900 hours. I'll probably be leaving fairly shortly to start some dinner, and then might be back in time for the actual midnight celebration.
Oh, it's 1900 hours to the midnight for you?
It's not quite midnight here yet. It'll be a few hours.
Oh, yes. No, I see. That is what your clock is right now. I thought it's what was left.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I see. So it's not so long, but it's long enough.
Time to go have some dinner first. In fact, I think I'm going to do that now. So I hate to leave you alone in the room, but then I'll be back probably 2-3 hours from now.
Yeah, I maybe not be still here. It's get very little quiet if no one talks.
I think you might be alone in your time zone at this moment.
Yeah.
Well, good night, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. See you maybe next year.
I hope much sooner. I hope we find a chance to meet again.
Yeah. So, hello. I am alone. Ah, oh, you're back.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had to go walk my dog there.
Yeah, I remember. When you said it, I remember you was going in a quick walk. I'm still as shoppy as last time.
No, you sound fine now.
Me and Bushokuman find out it may be because something in the between. I'm not sure where the fiber is bad. It's not in my house.
It's all the people posting on Facebook about Happy New Year.
Yeah. Sometimes I have very fast speed. I checked it. It's faster than last time I checked it. I got around, I think, 4 more megabytes down and 1 megabyte up, more and less, last time I checked.
Oh well, no luck.
Did you do a restart?
Yeah, I got it installed fine and everything, but it's not working.
So the kernel is not working?
Well, I mean, the kernel's working, but it's not, I don't have any sound still.
Oh, so the kernel didn't fix the sound problems then?
No, it didn't.
So you're hunting for other kernel then to fix the problem?
No, I'm starting to think about something else.
I can hear you and you can hear me and not see the problem.
Yeah, laptop speakers suck anyway. Just use headphones.
Yeah, I use headphones right now.
I got these itty bitty speakers that I've got plugged into the computer.
Yeah, they sound like they work for you.
Oh, I've got earbuds, and I got a brand new headset that's got a mic on it, but I'm just so sick and tired of having shit on my head, you know, it's really pissing me off. That's why I want my internal speakers to work, you know?
But you can maybe find bigger things to plug in, not really just the tiny kind of thing.
Well, the best thing for right now, until I get the internal speakers to work on this laptop, is just to use these plug-in speakers, you know?
Yeah, you can find better plug-in speakers if you have the small ones. They come in different sizes, speakers you can plug in your PC. Hello?
I'm reading something right now.
Oh.
So on my desktop, I don't actually have any speakers. Like, I have no real need for them. I pretty much wear headphones all the time for it.
I have 4 speakers, and I use headset. Always when I talk to people.
You mean you don't even have built-in speakers on your computer?
Not on my desktop, no.
If you never use them, why, you just need them.
Exactly.
For my deal, I really, really don't want it to be built with this building, so I just live with it. What's your favorite text editor?
I'm a Vim guy, myself.
Ah. LeafPad.
I started learning myself Emacs lately.
I know quite a few people that really, really dig Emacs, and I mean, for me, it's not what I need.
I dig Vim. I used Vim like a year or so now, and I thought, what do I need to learn? Next to Emacs, the hardest one. It's easier to talk Emacs versus Vim if I understand both.
Although I will admit that if I do need to just like copy and paste something real quick, I'll usually just use like gedit or something simple like that.
Yeah. Have you ever tried Nano?
I used Nano for quite a long time.
Me too. I used Nano, I think, for 3 years before I learned Vim.
I believe it was one of the default like editors for Debian back in the day when I used it.
Meh. It's the default for very many distros that doesn't have Vim or Emacs at all.
I also believe Slackware used it.
Slackware? It has a Debian spin.
No, Slackware is super old school. It was one of the
Slackware.
Original.
Oh, Slackware, yes. Mm-hmm. I thought about trying it, but it's still too hardcore for me.
Like I was telling people earlier, Slackware was the first distro I used because I wanted to get the more hardcore Linux experience and just really learn the ins and outs of it.
Yeah, I think sometimes I need to do the hardcore. Maybe try Arch first and then Slackware.
Yeah, give Arch a go. If you have like a spare machine that you're not really using or just can like mess around with, just slap it on there and just go for it.
Yeah, I'm thinking of doing it in a VirtualBox. I think it's boring to watch it waiting and doing things. Only it doesn't find the time to try to read up on that.
Yeah, it's really one of those things you gotta just sit down and do. Like, some people, it's not for them. Other people, they really dig it. I'm one of those people that just really dig it.
Yeah. Sometimes I dig it, but sometimes I think I have installed too many virtual boxes this year, and I thought I need a timeout on it. Do other stuff on my computer, not only install new virtual box.
Yeah, you can really burn yourself out doing things like that.
Yeah, I think I maybe done that. I was very into Linux, and now I'm less into Linux. I still read my news Linux stuff, but I doesn't do Linux so much more. I hope I get into it again. Now I'm starting to get into Mumble again. I burn myself on Mumble.
I do pretty much everything with free and open source software, except for like anything on my phone. That's just kind of its own deal.
Yeah. You can maybe do totally open source on phone if you really want to.
Yeah, I could. But I used to be really, really into like flashing ROMs and rooting phones, and I really kind of burnt myself out on that too.
Yeah, I remember jailbreaking my iPhone many, many years, and then I just stopped with the last one. I buy each iPhone. The first thing I do after I buy them was rooting them, and I was so happy about it.
I tried using an iPhone for about a week, and it wasn't for me. Like, I come from, you know, a hardcore like Android background, so it was just, there were too many things I didn't enjoy. Like if I decided to change the font size, it decided, oh, I need to reboot the phone. I'm like, why? That is ridiculous.
Oh, I thought the same experience. I used by the Android phone and thought, maybe I need to learn this kind of thing. And it's so different from my normally iPhone routines. And in the start, I didn't understand why my phone always burned out my battery on Android. It took me half a year before I find out why it just burned out in like 4 hours. It's what said, in 4 hours, you non-use. The problem was it's auto-updating kind of thing.
Oh, that reminds me. I got to get in touch with that guy by the name of Joe something that I met here on this channel here, because that site that I gave him, that video that I gave him about all the interesting stuff, I turned that around and I found out that it was all nothing but lies. It's their twisted version of satirical. You know, I hate when that happens. It's so freaking humiliating that I have to go back to somebody and tell them, you got to just forget the site that I gave to you before, because I found out that it's nothing but lies. You know, it doesn't make me feel really good.
Good you are not a news reporter then.
Well, what they call satire today is not the same thing that satire was back in the old days. It's totally, completely different things.
So it was funny before, but not anymore.
Well, like, for example, one site that was supposed to be a site of satire, they're talking about a plane crash. Now, would you tell me, satire is supposed to be humorous, right? What the fuck is so humorous about a plane crash?
Insanely dark humor, then.
What if it was a really little plane filled with a lot of clowns?
And then this site that I gave Joe the information on was videos on a certain channel on YouTube. This guy is on there. He creates this other video, all puffed out. He's a really big man, right? Because he got people to believe all this shit that's not true. And then when I found that out, I figured, oh, fuck, not another one of these things, you know? And then now I got to tell Joe that it's nothing but lies.
I hope he called back then. He's not gone because you fed him lies.
Well, I'll catch up with the guy sometime and tell him. I just hope you didn't take it so seriously like I did. I really believe this stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I remember taking a TV show really serious. I thought this was a documentary, but it wasn't.
So anyhow, he creates a video on how stupid is people. You know, how stupid is somebody to believe this? How stupid is somebody to believe that? You know, it's like, the only thing that he's doing is putting these videos out there to treat humans, all humans, like they're fucking stupid. And the more he treats people like they're stupid, I guess the more he feels like he's fucking worth something.
So he really pissed you off then?
Oh yeah, it really severely pissed me off. I wonder if I'm still missing that firmware that the terminal mentioned something about. Because I did everything after that. I mean, I did the updates, I did upgrades, I did the disk upgrades, I did the auto removes, reboot, all this and that, you know, so.
Alright. Are you eating something?
Yeah, a cookie.
Ah, after Christmas then.
I got this box of Pepperidge Farm cookies. There's 9 different types of cookies in the box, and the thing was half price, so it was a good deal.
Yeah. And I remember you say it's more a cookie country than what normally other countries.
Yeah, that's my missing Linux firmware thingies. Now I just got to figure out if they're still missing or if it just eventually pulled the stuff in.
You can maybe search for it and try if you can download it somewhere.
Boy, Sky's having a good time.
What, guys?
She's running in and out the window.
Oh, the cat. Simba.
Yep.
I got a link for you.
Okay.
It's a movie I maybe think you maybe like.
I tell you, a lot of these people at Ubuntu are assholes.
Simba, did you see some of the trailer?
Just suck. Yeah, that's a great video. That kind of reminds me of one I saw not too long ago that was more like a documentary.
Yeah, I watched it, I thought, this is something Simba maybe want to see. It's your kind of topic, kind of movie.
Yeah, there was a very long documentary. I think it was about pretty close to an hour long. And it was showing this this place really close to a downtown section of a really, really big city, like in Europe or something like that. And it's like there was old dilapidated buildings, like great big huge office buildings that was like in ruin. And the cats kind of took them over as a place to live. And it was kind of following the life of these cats, you know, as they, you know, lived in this busy town. And when they encountered humans and stuff like that.
Meh, fun.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I really don't want to be an Ubuntu freak or anything like that, is because a lot of these people on these Ubuntu forums are cold-blooded, ignorant motherfuckers. Well, for example, this question appears to be off-topic. The users who voted to close this gave this specific reason. This is not about Ubuntu. Questions about other Linux distributions could be asked on Unix and Linux. Those about Windows on SuperUser. Those about Apple products on Axe Different. And generic programming questions on Stack Overflow. Excuse me, this guy is on Ubuntu. So what the hell are they talking about? And not only that, if you go a little bit farther down, I am voting to close this question as off topic because the question is about an unsupported kernel. This kernel is supported. It is a stable kernel. So what the hell is their problem?
Is that the kernel you're using right now? You got the link?
Yeah, I got Linux, and the guy that asked the question on this forum also is on Linux.
Do you got the link to your thing?
Yeah, if you want to read it to see how ignorant these people are, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, the person's coming to get help and they treat them like shit.
That sounds like what Arch Linux is doing to new people. How did you find this? Did you use Google search it?
Well, all I did is I went to Google and I pasted in the message I was getting from my terminal when I installed that kernel.
And this popped up.
Yeah, that was one of the things that popped up in the results.
I used from 2 months ago, I joined this place to get answers on some questions.
Oh, here, he's actually somebody's asking something. May I ask why this is off topic? It is regarding Ubuntu 16.04 and the 4.8 kernel installed from the Ubuntu kernel PPA. And then the person that responds says, it is considered off topic because there is no official release using the kernel 4.8 at this time, and thus no official support.
Yeah. And that's your thing you're using right now. What?
No, that person that told him that reminds me of that asshole that treated that other guy like crap on the Red Hat site.
Yeah.
You know, this guy comes to the Red Hat forum because he's got a problem with his computer. He really, really needs help bad. And so he gets on there and he puts in his question. And they asked him, they said to him that your particular distro is very close to its end of life right now. If you encounter the same problem after you upgrade to the next one, please contact us. Now, to me, you know, that is just like pushing shit aside, you know. That is telling him, okay, we're not going to help you now. If you upgrade to the next one and it's in the next one, then contact us. So that means that they're going to be ignorant enough to allow it, to allow the problem to go into the next version? I mean, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, they hoped maybe someone else fixed it, so they just need to do it. They are lazy then.
Well, I think I'm going to go to Open Linux community in case anybody comes in over there. And if anybody wants me to, everybody wants to follow me over there, I can give them the information.
As far as I know, I think it's just like 4 people active in here.
Actually, this is the most people I've ever seen in here.
Yeah. No, I mean active who is still around to talk back to you. Mr. Weckley and the new guy who's popped in, and Dudeman is the people who last said or write something in the last half hour or so. I was thinking of maybe going off, and you were thinking of leaving, so I can maybe follow you to the next channel and talk a little and leave.
Well, anyhow, if anybody wants to follow me, I'm going to go back to Open Linux community. Everybody take it easy and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye, guys.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Let's try this again. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
A little bit quiet in here tonight.
Yeah, I leave for a few hours and it gets all quiet.
So it would seem.
That has nothing to say with anything about you, Fweeb.
Yeah, it's not like I was talking a whole lot when I was here earlier.
I thought it was just me.
So do I sound okay then?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, cool. I'm coming to you over Bluetooth to my phone. So come on, everyone. There's got to be something we can talk about.
I just made coffee.
Coffee's delicious.
The difficulty is I haven't been listening to the feed, so I don't know what we haven't already talked about.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat.
That's the point of this, though, isn't it? That you get a rotating cast of people, and even if you talk about the same thing over and over again, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because it's new people talking about it.
Fair enough. Who do we have that's actually active right now? I haven't been actually looking at whose names have been lining up. I recognize John KT4KB, and I heard Taj's voice. And are you Joe Ress too?
Yes. For some reason, Joe Ress is my normal name, and that wouldn't connect because I think I connected and then it timed out or something.
Right on. Well, welcome to the second iteration of you.
Indeed, and this is actually the second time that I've been on this channel this evening.
Oh, so totally appropriate to have the two there.
Yeah, I suppose it is. So for me, it's 2017 now, and I suppose the obvious thing to talk about is 2017, the year of Linux on the desktop, question mark.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
I was just hoping you were going to tell me that 2017 was already better than 2016.
Apparently not with that choice of topic.
Well, for me, probably 2012, 2011 was the year of Linux on my desktop.
Yeah, I was just about to say something similar, except thinking for me it was 98.
Tuck your beard back in there, Fweeb.
I'm an internet old fart.
I don't know, can we call 2017 the year of nobody cares if you use the Linux desktop because everything's web-based and it doesn't matter anymore?
I think that's been the case for a good few years by now, hasn't it?
I don't know, it seems like I used to get a lot angrier that I couldn't do things, and now it seems like I can do whatever I want. There's very few things, and when it does happen, I'm like, really? There's not a web client for that?
Well, I was talking to an old friend about this a couple of nights ago, and it depends what you want to do. I mean, if you're talking about your basic browsing, email, and the kind of stuff that you can do through a web browser, then Linux is absolutely fine and has been for a very long time. But if you're looking to make money from your computer, then Linux is not quite there yet, and not because the platform itself isn't ready. It's been ready, as far as I'm concerned, for at least 5 years, if not a lot longer. It's the applications that are available on it, specifically the proprietary ones that aren't available, and there simply aren't good enough free software equivalents.
Name one.
And okay, we're going to go there.
Considering the fact that I've been making my living using just Linux on a desktop with creative applications for over a decade.
Right, well, this is something that I'd be very keen to hear about. What kind of creative stuff are you doing for a living, and what applications are you using on the Linux desktop in order to do that?
Primarily animation and graphic design. And, so Blender's my power workhorse, but GIMP, Krita, Inkscape, Scribus, you name it.
Well, graphics, specifically Blender, I mean, my understanding from talking to Campbell Barton about it is that Blender is it's certainly up there, if not it's one of the industry standards. And graphically, we seem to be pretty much there on the Linux desktop. I mean, GIMP, although it's different from Photoshop, it can do an awful lot of what it can do. And I hear that Inkscape is good. I've never worked with vectors personally. And so graphics and animation, we're winning. But the other creative stuff, not so much. I mean, the classic one is video editors. But something that's closer to my heart is audio. And the fact is that Pro Tools is the industry standard. You can go into any studio anywhere in the world, and if you know how to use Pro Tools, you can use that studio.
I suppose that's the question: is are you looking to fit into somebody else's pipeline, or are you looking to do work? Because if you're working in somebody else's pipeline, then regardless of wherever you go, you're going to be stuck with whatever they use, unless you happen to be in a position to change it. But if you're on a freelance side of things, nobody cares, and it works great. I've got a friend of mine who exclusively uses Ardour and one other application that I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, I mean, it's a doable thing, but it's a lot easier to do it when you're a freelancer than trying to jack into somebody else's pipeline. That much I'll give.
Well, I would actually disagree with that. Case in point is a very, very good friend of mine who is a post-production sound engineer, dubbing mixer, I suppose, for TV, working in London as a freelancer, working for various production companies. And the fact is that it's a very common occurrence that he will not see a job through from start to finish. He will be part of a team. He will be assigned a couple of days doing preparation, for example, or he'll be doing finishing, or, you know, he'll be doing something in the middle. And everybody has standardized on Pro Tools, from the video editors down to the audio editors, and they can share session files and, you know, zip it up as, you know, including all the audio or whatever, and transfer it around using the internet. And so it's no good for him to say, I use this completely different thing and I will do a little bit of it on that, because that's no use to anyone else who's part of the chain. And so you have this problem of lock-in, proprietary lock-in, and, you know, it's something that I have discussed many times with many different people. But the fact is that that is the reality of the commercial world, certainly in the post-production audio industry within London, and from what I can tell, worldwide.
Well, I'm not disputing that vendor lock-in is a problem. It also depends on what your deliverables are going to be. And, you know, if you're going to be working more as part of a pipe, or if you're working directly for a client. I mean, the what you said was that it's not possible, and that's patently untrue. Now, if it's just tougher if you want to work with other people as part of a pipeline. But if you're working directly with a customer, directly with a client, on and your deliverable is a audio file or a video file or a still image, it's completely doable and has been for years.
I'm kind of two minds about it, because I, on one hand, I agree with Lee, but then on the other hand, I know when I got out of school, when I went to go get jobs, I mean, when you'd walk into a studio, they were like, okay, this is a Pro Tool shop / Final Cut shop, or this is an Avid shop, or, you know, they expected you to walk in and know that tool chain. But with that being said, now that I don't do that, actually, once you got your foot in the door, you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. Maybe it was just where I worked. You got your own projects and you just worked on your projects and whatever. But as far as like video editing, because that's the big thing I deal with, I've not found many use cases where Caden Live wouldn't do what I wanted it to do. Now, I would have to wade through a lot of jank to get to it, but it was doable. And I think it's just not a lot of people, the whole time is money thing. If it's something that they're just easier to do in another suite, they will do it there just to save time. But I don't think it's lack of tools being able to do things. I think it's just lack of the workflow being popular enough to where people feel like it's easy to learn.
But if you're using Caden Live for stuff, presumably that must be some sort of web content. That can't be, for want of a better word, proper professional content. Because the thing is that as a post-production sound engineer, you are producing not just a stereo audio file. You are producing a Pro Tools session, which is then sent to the video editors to sync with the what they call the online edit. And so I don't know, what kind of media were you working with in Caden Live?
I mean, we've done commercial video things for advertisements and stuff, and you know, informational things for universities around here or businesses and stuff. I mean, we did a lot of training videos and things like that, to where we did it all in-house. We did the audio and we did the video production in-house, so it didn't really matter. As long as I could get back to the source, whatever it was, especially if I was doing mix down on the video, if I could go to like Steve, I just made up Steve, but let's imagine Steve worked there. If Steve was doing the audio and he was the engineer that recorded it, I didn't really care what he'd recorded it in. As long as I could get the files to put in and sync them, it really didn't matter to me, but that was the workflow we had. And, you know, we were just working with the local media and stuff around here.
It seems that it's just a different world then. I mean, it's a world that I have dabbled in, albeit very briefly. It's not something that I do personally as a profession, but it's something that I've seen in action. And it just seems that my friend, who is one of the he is a successful working post-production sound engineer in London, let's put it that way. Whether or not he's one of the best, that's clearly subjective. But for him to do his job, and from what I have seen of the open source alternatives to Pro Tools, I think it would be impossible for him to do it, because there are so many plugins that he needs, and those plugins are so powerful that although you can do something close to it with some of the plugins for Ardour and stuff, I just can't see it being possible. And similarly with video as well. I mean, I have edited video in OpenShot and Caden Live and done a reasonable job of it. But to get something that is, you know, for example, in a Hollywood movie or on the BBC, it just doesn't seem possible to me.
It's possible, but you have to build your pipe around it. And that's the issue. And I think it's a question of what type of work you want to do and who you want to work for. For me, I've never wanted to be in a big pipe. I've never wanted to focus on a specific one task in a large chain. That's not been my interest. So I'm I have the luxury at the expense of maybe some lucrative, depending on what field you're in, money income, but by working with smaller customers, we're working directly with a customer or a client who actually wants the final output. I get to choose not just what I'm working on, but I also choose what I do it with. I've even fired customers before, based on them being jerks. But and it's the same sort of thing. If you're interested in working in a large production pipeline, we'll say Pixar or DreamWorks or any of those. We're going to talk animation because that's sort of what I know most. Then you're going to use their tools primarily, and you're going to work on their projects primarily. If you want to work on your own stuff, either you've got to spend your time and work yourself up the chain, or you're just going to have to do that on the side. So, but if you have a more direct interface with an end client and work on a smaller set with a smaller pipe, then you have a lot more freedom and you have a lot more control.
Because at the end of the day, it's all that matters is what you deliver to them. If they are looking for 4K video or 1080p video, whatever it is, as long as that is a professional end file, that's all they're bothered about. That's what you're getting at here.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
But if you're part of a bigger chain, as you say, then you all need to standardize on a set of tools. And in the audio visual world, that is Pro Tools and Avid. And if you deviate from that, then you're not going to get work, basically.
Well, you have to standardize on at least an interchange format. For instance, if you're talking video editing, and I've done this before, you could take an edit from Blender, for instance, if you're going to use that as an editor, or Kdenlive. I'd have to check if it's possible with Kdenlive. I'm pretty sure it is. But you can take an EDL, an edit decision list that's for an Avid, or when Final Cut was actually a thing, do it for Final Cut, and you can export your edit decision list based on your source media. They'd have the same source media, and you can basically import the edit from that. That's a possibility. You just have to standardize on the tool set and the interchange format for doing that. Now, whether or not the people you work with are willing to, acquiesce to making those kinds of adjustments, that's something you take up on an individual level. And I don't want to put it this way, but I don't have a better way to put it. If you're good enough for them to want to work with you, then some of that stuff is negotiable. It's harder to do when they say, I need an InDesign file or I need a Pro Tools file, right? When that's your deliverable, that becomes a much more difficult thing to do. But if they say, I need a 3D model, then maybe you can give them an FBX or an OBJ file and go from that. If they're looking for just an audio file, then a WAV file or a set of synced WAV files would do.
And I think
Are we not getting there into compatibility issues, slight compatibility issues? For example, I can send someone a file that I've created in LibreOffice, and they will attempt to open it in Microsoft Office, some version of that, and it will mostly work, but it won't be 100%. And in a professional environment, there is simply no time for it to not be 100%.
I don't necessarily agree with. I'm not trying to be contrarian here, but I don't necessarily agree with that, because I've written in LibreOffice I had a couple books published. I wrote them in LibreOffice, and they're working in MS Office, and the differences were tolerable. Again, part of that has to do with maybe they just didn't complain loud enough to me, or it was good enough for them to do the last 10% on that.
Yeah, if it was just words and paragraphs and the fonts might have been different and some of the spacing might have been different, but they can pay an intern to sort that kind of stuff out. But if you're talking about spreadsheets and more complicated things, macros and, more intense, complicated uses of it, that's when you start to see compatibility issues.
And you do. But again, it's at that point in time, it deals with who you're working with and trying to baseline that, and it's a negotiable thing.
I'll put it this way. I have sent people .doc files that I've created with LibreOffice or possibly AbbeyWord. I've tried both. And they've said to me, I can see the amount that we owe you, but I can't see your bank details, so we can't pay you. And that is when I realized that I had to start exporting it as a PDF. And okay, well, that's not a huge deal, but a small business person like myself, that's not a huge issue. But if you're in a large enterprise, that kind of stuff is simply not going to wash. It's at that point, managers say to you, you've got to stop using this Mickey Mouse open source free stuff. We're a Microsoft shop here. And, you know, if you're an independent freelancer, okay, fair enough, like I am, you can find ways to get around it, export as a PDF, for example, as I said. But if you are in an enterprise, that just doesn't happen. And you don't have the opportunity. You are dictated to from on high. And Microsoft has this stranglehold. And that is just a microcosm for all of the other industries that use computers professionally. And like my friend who works at Pro Tools, it is dictated to him on high from the effectively agents for whom he works that he must use Pro Tools. And for him to use anything else, even another proprietary solution like Cubase, would be absolutely unacceptable. And so I think that those of us in this open source and Linux bubble, we can sometimes forget that the reality of 95% of the working world simply can't use open source software because they're just not allowed to by the nature of the organizations either in which or with which they work.
It's harder, but it's not impossible. I stopped freelancing about 4 years ago, and I work in a larger company now. Now, granted, I'm the only Linux guy in the entire company, and it's almost entirely a Microsoft shop, so some things are complicated. But I'm permitted, if you will, to use my open source toolchain for every part of the business that I touch.
And I think it is... It may be uncomfortable, but it is negotiable because I think about things that get sent around. I'm a teacher, so I work in a school district, and it's a significantly large school district. So I'm not a special snowflake in a little pond. It's fairly large, but they'll send out Microsoft files that I can't use, and I just literally send them back an email and say, I don't use Microsoft anything. I don't own it. I'm not going to purchase it. If you want me to do this, you need to change it into some kind of file format that I can read. And never has that been an issue. Usually the person is just like, oh, sorry, and sends me the thing I need. So I don't know. I guess it's just maybe you just kind of have to be an a-hole about it, and I'm just good at doing that. I don't know. But I've never really had a problem.
I was going to say, are you not the person that everybody secretly hates then?
I don't care. I really don't care. I think I'm morally right, so I'll be that guy, I guess.
So, Taj, you don't have to have the 5-minute conversation about what is open source, and then how is everything not Windows or not Microsoft?
I mean, I don't have that conversation anymore, and I think most people who I have had that conversation with either just roll their eyes. Or because I mean, I'm a teacher, but I work for the tech department too. So like all the tech people know, just like don't even start with me because I'll go on, you know, proselytizing free software. But I think most people don't care to listen to it. And I don't care to spend my time talking about it anymore. And I'm just kind of known as that guy. Like people just, they see me doing my work at school and they see a black screen in Emacs and they're just like, you're a fucking wizard. Like they don't even know how to approach me with technical stuff. And I feel like a lot of times if I'm like, I can't read this because it's in Microsoft, they're just like, okay, we must have done, like they feel like it's their problem for some strange reason. I don't know, maybe it's just a unique situation I'm in, but I've never had a problem just being like, hey, I can't read this, change it to what I need, and people just do it. I mean, I guess if you just ask people, do things.
Yeah, and I'm sort of in a similar boat. I mean, it's like that was a condition upon which I hired. Like, can I use my tools? And occasionally, you know, every now and then, there's the, you know, trying to connect to somebody else's WebEx or something like that. You might have a hiccup or there, and someone will chuckle about Linux problems, and then their entire system will crash. And how or they'll get something caught in a crypto locker, and they'll laugh about their Windows problems. So it's at this point it's I feel the abuses on parity, but it's not, yeah, I'm sort of in the same boat.
Could it be that Apple and Google are actually to thank for this idea that people will accept that there's more to Office documents than just Microsoft? In as far as there was a time when it was Microsoft Office and that was it, whereas now, because of Google Docs and Drive and all that kind of thing, and the fact that there are more Macs, the fact there are more Chromebooks, that there's a kind of, I suppose, fracturing, you know, of the Office market, to the point where it's not uncommon to send someone who doesn't care at all about Linux and software freedom. You know, you send something to them and they can't open it because they've got a Mac, say, or because they're on a Chromebook. And so it's becoming more and more common to have to send things a couple of times in different formats until it works with everyone. And so in this weird way, it's almost that Apple and Google are helping us against Microsoft.
Well, Microsoft certainly didn't help themselves either when they hit their Office interface with an ugly stick and put a ribbon in there. That's
coming to LibreOffice, so let's not joke too much about that.
Well, yeah, but at least I think it's turn-offable, I hope. In any case, that didn't hurt. Microsoft didn't help themselves with that, and I think there's a lot of people looking for alternatives. But I think also there's a greater awareness and a greater understanding of vendor lock-in, of, you know, these, especially when you get into a subscription-based scenario and software as a service-based scenario now, where, you know, you're running Adobe Cloud right now and you've got a file for a layout that you did in InDesign, and oh, guess what, you can't open it because your cloud subscription canceled and no one else can open it unless they have a cloud subscription. People are starting to become much more aware of that, and so interchange formats that are compatible and easily openable from other programs are more desirable.
And
was it almost a year ago, I think it was, possibly a little bit longer, the whole Adobe Cloud was down for at least 12 hours, I think, and there were professionals all over North America who simply couldn't get the job done because they couldn't access any of their files. And, you know, it's not only if you've failed to pay your subscription, even if you have paid it, sometimes that's not enough to access it.
Yep.
I'm going to agree, Joe, with what you said 100%, because I think it's actually gone past what you said, and it's on the other side of that. Google Docs has become such a standard for, I know for my school district, all the kids have Chromebooks, all the teachers have Chromebooks, like everything we do is Google-based, and pretty much all the districts around us are kind of the same way, that if you send somebody a Word file, they're like, I can't collaborate with this, we can't do these things that I can do in Google Docs. This is so antiquated. Like, it's almost been to where Google has lapped us, and now open source is still trying to play catch up because LibreOffice can't get an online collaborative version on its feet that actually works. So I think Google has become the new Microsoft, and that is the new target that everybody is kind of going towards and is expecting to work. Case in point, our assistant principal at our school, he's brand new, moved in from out of state. They used Microsoft Excel, and he was just shooting out Excel spreadsheets to everybody because it's education and Excel spreadsheets are a thing. And everybody's like, we don't even have computers that can open this. Like, everybody's on on a Chromebook. Like, we don't have Word. So you're going to have to, like, transfer this into something we can use. So, I mean, that's almost become the new de facto standard, which I don't think is healthy either, at least not without some kind of answer from the free and open source community.
Well, it's funny that you talk about that, how prevalent Google services are in education. And I hear stories about how Chromebooks are outselling iPads this year, last year for me, 2016. It's 2017 for me now. But I was speaking to a friend of mine who works for, I don't want to narrow it down too much, but a major games company in the US. So he's very much in the enterprise. There are, I think, at least several hundred people working in this games company. And I asked him, are you going online? You know, are you moving to Google Docs away from this idea of local applications? And he said to me that while they're moving to Office 365, the Microsoft online solution, collaborative and all that, Google is not considered secure enough. And I said to him, that's a bit strange. Surely Google's secure. He said, well, it's not necessarily about security on an individual basis. It's the fact that Google's whole raison d'etre, their whole business model is based around gathering data and exploiting that data. And so they are just not trusted within the enterprise. However, you look at education and you see how Google is doing so well because it's free. They're offering their services free, gratis, free as in beer. And that is very attractive to school districts with very limited budget. When you start to get into the enterprise and you have more of a budget, then they can start to look at, well, they can continue to look at Microsoft solutions. But what seems to me the genius of Google is that they have almost ignored the enterprise and gone for education, because what is the future of enterprise? You know, education now is tomorrow's enterprise, isn't it? If you get all of the students hooked on Google services now, then when they progress through college and university and grad school and all the rest of it, and then into serious employment, the enterprise, then they're used to using Google services. And so it seems to me that Google, in this sense, is playing the long game. And it's no less worrying than you just pointed out there, but it's very interesting to me that you've got this Google creeping up on Microsoft.
The thing is, though, that Apple basically tried to play that game in the 80s and 90s, and it didn't kind of work out great all of them. They kind of needed some cash infusion from Microsoft to not die with that strategy.
And
but except that they...
I just to clarify, I just didn't want it to go without being said. Google Apps for Education is not free. We have to pay as a school district for it. It's basically the same as their enterprise package. We have to buy into it to get the service and to get the storage and to get the management software that they use for provisioning Chromebooks and all that stuff. It all comes as part of a package. And we pay that to Google just like a business would. I don't know the number off the top of my head because we did it 3 years ago and I can't remember how much it cost, but it's not an insignificant sum of money for a school district to use Google Apps for Education.
Well, that was my mistake then. I wonder how that compares to similar Microsoft offerings in terms of cost then.
A lot less, like several zeros less.
Yeah, so I was talking about it being free, and you know, perhaps I misspoke there, but so it is fair to say that it is significantly less costly than Microsoft and therefore far more attractive to stretched school districts.
Yes, and you can already see Microsoft is trying to backpedal and change that. They nonstop have reps calling like, hey, here's our new switch over to Office 365. You can use it on Chromebooks and stuff. And they're trying, but I think you're right. Google got their foot in the door and they've entrenched themselves so hard that now it's more of a pain. They could almost make it free and it's more of a pain to switch over everybody than it is to just go with the status quo.
Well, as I see it, years ago, I'm talking about in the probably early 80s, Apple got their foot in the door of education where I was at the time and creeped in by giving, you know, if you give away a little bit of milk, eventually the school districts buy the cow. And that may not be the greatest analogy, but in all the different businesses I've been a part of in my 56 years, when it comes to technology, when people start giving stuff away, the people that are paying the bills tend to go in that direction until somebody comes along like Google has and takes a few of them zeros off. I know in what I do now in telecommunications, used to be Lucent. And Cisco came in and threw some products that were equally suited and took a few of the zeros off. And guess what? They started going away from Lucent equipment. It's I think it's partially business. You and I who are out here on the you know, using the equipment don't always get what's best for whatever we're trying to undertake.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and Microsoft did take a something from Apple's page. I mean, up through the 90s, Apple pretty much, well, I wouldn't say gave away computers, but huge discount. In fact, I've got, you know, probably archived 30 68K Apple machines from Macintosh from when the school district you know, finally got rid of them that I was working for. But you know, but Microsoft figured this out, and I'm sure they're still doing it. They were selling academic licenses for Office Pro for like 50, 60, 70 bucks, you know, rather than $300. If it had been $300 when I was working there, you know, it had been a lot easier to convince the school district to use LibreOffice instead, but, or OpenOffice, I guess, at that time. But, you know, when they're getting it for 60 bucks and it's what everybody else uses, you know, I replaced the workstations in the library, and they said at the time, well, no, we really don't need Office on there. They're just going to use them for internet access. And then they found the students were, you know, going to do their homework and in the library and saying, hey, what is this LibreOffice thing that we don't know? And they, you know, they came back to me and said, well, you know, what is that thing you put on there? I said, well, you didn't want to spend the money for Microsoft Office. As well, now we do. So, and Adobe, the same thing. You know, you get the Adobe software for a huge discount in academia, and they're doing this. You know, I don't think there's a profit model for them within academia, but they're trying to get the kids used to what, you know, when they graduate from high school, they know Office, they know Adobe products. But, you know, at this earlier in the conversation, I was reflecting on this is the vendor lock-in really is all the fault of everybody being on the web now, because there was a time before that, one customer would have Microsoft Office, the next customer would have the Lotus Office package, you know, somebody else would be using WordPerfect, somebody would still be using WordStar. You wouldn't believe how many people still want to run, before the Office, Microsoft had Office, the all-in-one package, and I'll think of it here in a minute. You know, I for years and years, I had to take old floppies and keep that going on each new version of Windows, because the secretaries just, that's what they were used to, and they didn't want to give it up.
Yeah, I think if we were
WordPerfect.
No, there was a Microsoft. They didn't call it an Office package because it was an all-in-one. We called them all-in-ones in those days.
Microsoft Works.
Works, that's it.
Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, God, Works. Hello, guys.
Hey, what's up, Joel? Now, I mean, I think if we're one of the things I think we're not taking into account, and it's 99% of the problems I've had trying to push for free and open source software in my district is it's not about the money. If it was about the money, everything would be moved over. It's about who is covering whose rear end and who they can complain to make things work. So we'll have two options on the table. One is a support contract to use such and such service, or we could self-host an open source solution. And it would cost less to use the open source solution, self-host it for the machine, to hire a tech, to just specifically, their job is to manage this thing. And to be honest, that's not what would happen. I mean, that person would probably be in charge of a few things. So really, you're going to distribute that cost, and you're looking at their salary and their benefits and all that, and you're taking that all into account. And we would save money going that way. And ultimately, when the superintendent and the director of tech are saying no to this, they're saying no because we don't have somebody to call and bitch to. Therefore, it's not, we the only person to blame is us, so we're not going that route. We're going to go with the proprietary solution, because then that gives us kind of this hotline to call and complain, and then we can point the finger at somebody else and say, that's why this doesn't work.
Everyone wants a scapegoat. That's why I have a job, for the most part.
Well, without a scapegoat, you know, they're the ones who...
That break up for me, gets or hurt. Is that breaking up?
Also, people, management looks at hiring people a lot different than it does paying for something. So if you have to hire somebody to support a piece of software, it's a very different expense, at least in many places, than it is when you have to just buy a license for something. At least that's how it's been where I've worked.
And also, we're not talking about the value proposition. If something is free, as in beer, then it must be worthless. And clearly, anybody who is sitting here on New Year's Eve / New Year's Day talking to me on this Mumble server knows that that is a ridiculous proposition. But if you are a middle manager in a large company, then... You know, it's like that old thing about no one ever got fired for buying IBM and stuff. No one ever got fired for buying Microsoft solutions. Whereas if something is free, then that can't be very good then, can it?
I don't know. I tend to think that the people I'm making the arguments to are smart enough to know better. I really think they are. They just, I don't know. They're more worried about their own, I guess, self-preservation than they are anything else.
Yeah, see, I don't think... the argument of if it's free it ain't any good makes a difference anymore, especially with you have things like kind of a poor example, but Facebook, Gmail, those things are quote-unquote free, and lots of people use them, including some of the people on this chat right now. So, and that isn't just a group of us. That's a group, wide group, of general computer people that use Gmail because it's free and it's good. So that's not necessarily an argument. It's more of, you know, if something goes wrong, the company wants somebody to blame. They want that indemnity. You know, they basically want to say, okay, instead of worrying about email, we're going to move all our email off to Office 365. So we don't have to worry about it anymore. That can be worried about by Microsoft. And we don't have to worry about taking care of the email servers or any of that mess.
Yeah, I was going to say, the people we're talking to are the ones that literally, when they get up from the table, are going to go back to their office to log on to their BSD server to, you know, check stuff out of GitHub and, you know, post, you know, make sure their Apache servers are running. Like, they understand what free and open source is. Like, they're not naive. They know what's going on. It's there's other motivating factors. And it could be the whole idea of, you know, it is different to hire a person as far as financially. I know in education it's exactly that, because it would come from two different funding pools, and that becomes its own morass of, I don't know, absurdity. But to me, it's just like, at the end of the day, people, that's not why they're not making those decisions. They're making them for other reasons.
Well, I mean, this is Red Hat's business model. I mean, you as a tech, you could go into a company and make the argument, well, let's just install CentOS instead. It's the exact same code, and it really is now, you know. But then you're taking on the responsibility of being able to fix everything, and it just takes one incident of the server being down for 8 hours on something mission critical that you can't figure out what's going on. For management to decide, well, maybe that wasn't maybe we ought to have gone with Red Hat.
That's exactly what I was just about to say there. Red Hat, I mean, that's why they are the most successful open source company, arguably, because of their support. Because if you are willing to pay for it, you can get 365, 24/7 support from them. And as an enterprise with mission critical infrastructure, as you talked about there, that's exactly what we're talking about. If something goes wrong, you can get it fixed incredibly quickly. You can have an engineer on site. You know, you have to pay for that, and you have to pay handsomely, and that's why they're a $2 billion company. But, why not just use CentOS? Well, because it simply doesn't have that guaranteed support that Red Hat does.
Yep. Well, that kind of goes from where I work. We certify Red Hat for use with our company's products. Okay. I know CentOS is the same, and I get this question all the time in preparation calls for server migrations, where they say, well, can we use CentOS? I have to say no, because it's not Red Hat. And you and I know it's the same code. In fact, our product would probably work just fine on Ubuntu for any reason. The company I work for, we do ERP systems for higher ed. Okay, so really, if it's a supported operating, if it's Linux, it should work. But we only certified Red Hat, and that's the only thing we use, and that's the only thing we will suggest using, unless you want to go with Microsoft or Solaris or EIX or anything else, because those are all supported solutions. And that's why Office is a supported solution to this day. Same thing for Adobe.
Well, don't you think a lot of that is if with Red Hat, if your company has an issue with your product running on that Linux server or box, they can go to Red Hat, and Red Hat's a big enough and responsive enough company that they're going to fix it. No matter what it is, when the corporations start talking to each other, they react. And sorry, Joe, for stepping on you.
Well, you could actually buy contracts for almost any Linux distribution anymore. So that's not as big of an issue as we may think it is anymore.
Well, that's what I was just going to bring up. Is that perhaps what Canonical with Ubuntu are doing wrong, in that they're offering it for free, as well as if you want to pay them for support, then that is an option. Whereas Red Hat, unless you're a developer, and fairly recently they've brought out this free developer subscription that's completely unsupported. But generally speaking, if you're an enterprise, you can't use Red Hat. You can use CentOS, but you can't use Red Hat. And therefore, maybe that's what Ubuntu is doing wrong. That's what I'm getting at here, is that the fact that if you're an enterprise, feel free to use Ubuntu and support yourself, no problem. Or if you want to come to us, we'll give you all the support that you want if you're willing to pay for it. And there's that kind of sort of what I was getting at there. Maybe I was coming at it from the wrong angle, saying that if it's free, it's worthless. But, you know, if you don't have to pay for support, then the temptation is not to do so. Whereas with Red Hat, there is no choice, apart from CentOS, which is a different thing, whereas Ubuntu is Ubuntu, whether you pay for support or not.
I think part of it is that a lot of companies, like especially my employer, who I will not be naming, they use Red Hat. I just hear the Linux clusters because I'm on the Windows side of development, unfortunately. And it has to be commercially supported. That was one of the reasons that a lot of the sites I work on are using IIS, because Microsoft will support it. And yeah, we've made use of that. We have sent dumps to Microsoft and they come back and analyze it. I mean, some enterprises have rules that say you have to have support. And I think Canonical should have been fine with that. Like they should have done well with that model, get Ubuntu installed and then you have commercial support. But as I've seen it, the infrastructure for things like enterprise level management has just centered around Red Hat, where you have big tools to do these huge installs, forest management, tree management, the server management, where you're doing large install management. Most of that is around Red Hat because they're the entrenched player. Canonical and Ubuntu is still fairly new, compared to Red Hat. So that stuff, while it may be coming out or may be there, it's not where people go when they think enterprise Red Hat and enterprise Linux. And Red Hat has done a very good job of marketing themselves as that. They're the enterprise Linux distribution.
Where does SUSE come into this? I know that it's more popular, much, much more popular in Europe, but it just doesn't seem to get a look in America. Well, the US, I suppose you would say.
I haven't seen too many Novell products used in, the old Novell NetWare, but I mean, I've seen Novell IDM used. It's like a management tool for Active Directory, but I have not seen any Novell Linux installs in where I've been working.
So no SUSE Enterprise Linux Server to be seen at all then?
Nope.
That very much backs up the stereotype then. I mean, I'm an outsider to this industry. I'm very much an enthusiast, I suppose, a reporter on it, maybe you might say. I'm not entrenched in it, but I hear that SUSE is massive in Germany and to some extent in the rest of Europe, whereas in America, well, you know, North America, it's just all about Red Hat.
Where is Canonical in the amount of paid contracts? Are they, you know, like fourth behind Oracle and SUSE?
Well, Canonical is still a private company, so their finances are not for the public record. So we don't know is the honest answer. We know they're bankrolled by a very rich man who's been into space and everything. But it's not a public company, is it? They haven't done an IPO and all the rest of it. So we simply don't know how they're doing financially. We can only, speculate based on evidence from the few crumbs that they feed us. But we have no idea. They could be very close to Red Hat. That seems incredibly unlikely, but we just don't know.
Well, I didn't mean in terms of income, though it would, you know, it would follow that the one follows the other. But, I was saying on the number of paid support contracts, I would think they would publish that information that, we're supporting this many desktops out there.
Well, number of desktops and number of contracts are different numbers, 50.
Well, that's true. Because the contract would have, you know, the contract would be for the whole enterprise, and then you'd have to figure out, you know, how many people are using it within that enterprise.
Not to mention the number of people who are using Ubuntu for free, be it at home or in the enterprise, with absolutely no support at all, apart from community forums and mailing lists and IRC and that sort of thing.
I think part of the problem, too, is the fact that a lot of stuff just works. You don't get into crazy support unless you're doing something really difficult with it or really interesting with it, like extremely high volume websites and things like that. And then really a lot of it is your application code.
Well, I mean, self-support is fine for small business and the individual customer. It's just if you're the tech in the office and, you know, like my example, your server goes down and you don't know what to do other than hit Google, you know, it only takes one instance like that before management wants to have somebody else that they can fall back on. And yeah, you'd probably be gone, or you, me, or anybody in that situation. Then the next guy would be dialing up Red Hat.
Not always. I mean, even if Canonical has support contracts, it's probably that the next course of action that would happen. I mean, I've seen lots of instances where people, you know, heads rolled because the email servers are going down, and it was really just they replaced the personnel, not the product. A huge server migration like that would cost money. So it might just be, again, Red Hat is very entrenched. And I've heard stories of startups that start using everything free because it's free, you know, startup culture, and then upper management makes them transition to Microsoft because that's where the quote support is. And we all know, we everyone on this channel knows that it's BS, but still.
Yeah, I haven't got one of those. Well, I guess because I'm doing all my telecommunications over the web or cell now. But it's been a long time since I've got one of those. Hello, this is Microsoft support and you have a virus phone calls.
That's stopped recently. My dad used to get them, and, you know, one of my parents were using Ubuntu, and he just starts toying with them.
Or they could do like what I do, like when I get any kind of telemarketer call, they get exactly one shot with me. All right, if I figure out who you are within 2 seconds, I hang up, and then I hit the block feature on my cell phone, which is really the only phone I ever use anymore.
The fun thing was I actually got one of those scammers, and I fired up the sacrificial ThinkPad. And I mean, it was so sacrificial. I went into a virtual terminal, you know, the control at F1, and made it so my wife's account still had sudo access, but mine didn't after I installed whatever remote control software they wanted. And those poor bastards, let me tell you, once they got into, you know, it was a bog standard Ubuntu install with one little difference. All I did was hide the dock so that you needed to use a hot corner to find it. And they started like hitting buttons and going through the settings tab and trying to get into a terminal. And it was 5 minutes of hilarity. And the reason I say 5 minutes is because then they stuck me on hold and I managed to go into the settings of the remote control program and remove their ability to make changes. And then the battery died in the ThinkPad. I mean, it is sacrificial. But at any minute, those people are messing with me and getting frustrated is a minute they're not scamming somebody else who will actually give them money.
And it's a minute of at least just entertainment.
It was funny. I wish I had recorded it.
So they actually do have, those guys have remote software that runs on Linux, or were you?
Yeah, they just use like log me in and use a code or whatever. And the funny thing is that the people who make log me in, they don't like it when their product is used for such scams. So they will knock out people's licenses for that shit.
I would think just immediately when the desktop comes up, they're going to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't Windows.
That was what I was hoping for. I didn't get it.
Wow. Must have been a really dumb guy.
Oh, well, wait, hold on. We know people who have Linux. Well, we'll have to transfer you to a senior guy. I'm like, okay, sure, great. And they were looking for the terminal. Idiots. It's Alt F2.
TeamViewer is probably used more for that than LogMeIn, though.
I've seen both.
But even if they could get to a terminal, surely without the pseudo password, they wouldn't be able to get very far, would they?
They would try to social engineer for you to type it in. But again, I went behind their back, effectively, by using the virtual terminal, because LogMeIn does not share VT, because it's basically a separate display to the machine. It's a whole separate login, and just took away my pseudos access. I just removed myself from the group. But because I had two logins on the machine, I wasn't going to lock myself out of it. I mean, a VM would have been easier to spin up, but I still had plenty of spare machines in the house.
I've been tempted before. I've had a call from that, and I've been in the middle of something, and I've kind of been thinking to myself, should I, shouldn't I? It might be quite funny. I could film it, or at least record the audio, put that on YouTube, but then I'm usually too busy. It's happened probably two or three times to me, but I suppose not in the last year, 18 months maybe. So hopefully these things are dying away, but maybe they just get wise to the people who, maybe you get off the list if you seem slightly technical.
Yeah, I got called once and I was like, thank you for calling, and they hung up immediately. But if you just say yes, okay, what, you just play dumb and you play along, that's what they're expecting. They're expecting people who don't question them. If you're too happy to see them, then they just leave.
I just think it's ironic the one time you get to talk to Tier 2 tech support is the scammers.
That's because you have to pay for the Tier 2 people.
I don't know. The one time I got a hold of Tier 3 tech support at my ISP, I literally had to spend 20 minutes explaining what port forwarding was to them. So my experience wasn't great.
Comcast?
No, Time Warner, just as bad.
Worse, I would say. I think Comcast, they know what port forwarding is because enough people ask them.
Yeah, I called my ISP the other day for tech support, and usually, during the weekday, business hours, you actually get one of their techs. And then after hours, weekends, whatever, you get a guy who's just, at a call center someplace and just recording stuff. And they can actually get into the transceiver from their end and look at it, so they're not completely clueless, but not as comfortable with that as I would be with one of the people actually working directly for the company who installed the system and everything. But yeah, that makes me glad that I may be switching ISPs, after that experience this last week and getting the call center guy in the middle of the business day.
I just wish my ISP would have the same name for more than 6 months without being bought by somebody else.
That's a bad sign. That's all right. I've had bad ISPs to the point where I was in the demo scene in the 90s, and there was a song floating around the internet called Fuck Brome's ISP. That's how bad it was. I may have it somewhere.
Wow, and there's me complaining that there's only one fiber provider to where I live, and the rest of the probably 20 or 30 other ISPs are only DSL.
Fiber, what's that?
Well, this was dial-up back in the day. You can, feel older, young now, accordingly.
Dare I say that I've got 200 megabit down then?
Go ahead. Hey,
you sound great. Upload.
Yeah, upload, I think 13. Nice.
Well, since I work for one of those fine companies, I'm just not going to say anything.
Is the ham radio a fallback for when their wires go down?
No. When the wires go down, this fella sitting here fixes them. I've been doing this a long time, and unlike some people in the industry, I really give a shit about my customers.
That, sir, makes you a rare breed, and I appreciate you.
Too bad you're not running the company.
So can we change topic completely, if that's okay? Are there any, we've talked about, you know, kind of server stuff and a little bit of desktop. Can we move into the 21st century a little bit and talk about mobile and where we think, you know, where we stand with the various mobile OSs? Obviously, iOS is of virtually no interest to anyone in this channel, I would imagine. But then, you know, Android and the whole Cyanogen mod and Lineage thing and Firefox OS, Tizen, Ubuntu, that kind of thing. Anyone interested in that kind of stuff?
Sure, but it's going to be a huge rant about Qualcomm for a while.
Yes, I'm interested. I'm not sure that the conversation will not become depressing quite quickly, but yes, I'm interested.
We touched on Lineage OS earlier today for a moment.
Well, I'm sort of looking forward to CyanogenMod getting back to being, you know, an actual mod rather than just like trying to be something it's not with a company. But, you know,
I completely agree. This is really, you must have had a pretty old device then.
At the time, I was running it on a Nexus S. Now I think the latest phone they support is a Galaxy S2. That's their best.
S2, right S3, now. Maybe, yeah.
Yeah,
the replicant can't be 100% free software because they can't connect to the cell network with completely free software.
Well, it's usually a separate processor. That was the biggest problem with the Dream and the Magic, which was the original Android phone, was the fact that the way they set up the two processors, what they call the application processor and the baseband, was that the baseband was the master processor. It wasn't like a modem connected by a serial line. It was actually the fact that the application processor is bootstrapped by the baseband processor. Think of like the Raspberry Pi, the video card is the one bootstrapping the application processor. It's the same type of deal. The Nexus S was a high-speed serial line, and the Galaxy Nexus and the S2s were actually like serial port type things where it was really disconnected. And yeah, you're only running free code on the application processor. And half the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth didn't work unless you restored the firmware files, which were not free, so they couldn't distribute them. But you could just pull them off of a working install or a CyanogenMod install like that.
So it was akin to flashing the Google apps on top of CyanogenMod then, you know, obviously a little bit more, you know, that's there's a lot more proprietary stuff already with the drivers and stuff in CyanogenMod.
Yeah, well, CyanogenMod would ship binary drivers. They would ship a driver that needed to work, like the camera, for example, and Replicant would just be like, nope, I'm sorry, you know, we'll reverse engineer the camera. I do remember with one of the phones, there was something called Yamaha Hell. It had to do with the fact that certain Yamaha audio drivers just were absolutely awful. And when the Replicant project reverse engineered them, CyanogenMod actually started using those drivers because they were better than the vendor supported crap that was being used. So it wasn't like this stuff happened in a vacuum, but, you know, code flowing the other direction was very low because it all had to be reverse engineered.
Replicant's not something I've looked into for an awfully long time because my devices are fairly new. I mean, I'm talking to you on a OnePlus One now, which by some standards is quite old, but by Replicant standards is quite new. So, I mean, where is the Replicant project now? Do you know? I mean, is it still
not
actively
really
developed?
There's still a mailing list and there's people on it, but I haven't run one in a while because every phone I've gotten since my Nexus S died, you know, I went with the Moto G line. I had the original Moto G. I saw the list of binary files in it and cried, just like the LG Nexus 4 had the same amount, about. It's just anything with Qualcomm, you're done. You're not running free software on those devices at all. And it really, it has to come down with the way the Linux ARM support is. It's just the board support packages are terrible.
Even worse with MediaTek, isn't it?
I wouldn't know, but I'm going to assume yes.
There aren't any processors. There aren't any ARM boards, really. I mean, even the Raspberry Pi, which is, I mean, I know there are proper free software, for, you know, open hardware boards available, but the Raspberry Pi is the kind of poster child. But even that is not 100% free software, is it?
No, and it will never be unless you can replace the video card firmware, and good luck with that. It's why I won't buy one. Everybody else talks about like they're the greatest things in the world, and it's like you do realize it's a crappy video processor, a crappy application processor sitting on top of a video card, right? And it's just to sell these boards.
Well, a conspiracy theorist perhaps might say that they don't, the Raspberry Pi Foundation don't care at all about free software, and they just want to sell their machines. Someone who is less conspiratorially minded might say that they only care about getting these boards in front of children and teaching them to code, and they are incredibly pragmatic about that, and they don't necessarily care whether it runs completely free software. They will take advantage of the fact that they can run Debian effectively on it, but it's software freedom is not high on their agenda. It's
well, I would tell you
that aware of.
As I have a friend who picked one of these up, and he wanted to use the Xbox One controller with RetroPie, and we spent quite some time looking for the right kernel headers, because there's like so that you can use the DKMS system to compile your own drivers, because he wanted to use an Xbox One gamepad with it. The 360 gamepad is very well supported for what he was doing with it. The One gamepad, you are SOL, and I could not find anything. I could not find any kernel headers for anything past 4.1. I was like, if Raspberry Pi cares about free software and getting kids to code, then they must be talking about application code. Because if you're going to do any kernel level hacking and you don't publish the proper kernel headers, you're done. Just stop there. And so I think
well,
my friend ended
Raspberry
up doing something else.
The Pi in Raspberry Pi stands for Python, or as you would say, Python. You know, that's they are not talking about low-level stuff at all. You know, they're not even talking about compiling things, really. Now, you can do a bit of Java and stuff on it, but they're talking about interpreted very high-level stuff.
And I would argue that if you're going to teach somebody how to compile and, you know, they want to go high and now they're limited by your hardware, your tool has only gone so far and it's not as effective. You can easily imagine a situation where a kid who's been programming for a while now wants to do something more in-depth or use the hardware in a different way, and software freedom is really the only way to go with it. As I said, I don't think it's a bad product, it's just I won't buy any for myself.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, totally. I mean, the thing is that you have a lot of other alternative boards with varying degrees of freedom. I'm not sure there are any that are completely free. But the thing about the Raspberry Pi is that it is so well supported, I suppose. I mean, it, not only are there, I think, however many million there are, I can't remember now if it's 5 or 10, or, you know, there are an enormous number of these things that are out there in the wild. And therefore, there's a huge community there to support it. There are a huge number of images available for it, including the official one, Raspbian, which I have some doubts about some of the security settings, certainly some of the defaults on that. But there are also other, you know, straight up GNU/Linux distros for it, like Ubuntu, Mate, and other flavors. But then there's other stuff like RISC-OS, and, you know, it's just so well supported that is why it's done so well, I think, because it's just the network effect.
Well, and I totally get what Brum's saying, like, and I wish I could be that guy. My whole thing with the Raspberry Pi is because it is so well supported, it's very easy to get money to buy them, especially in the educational realm. Like, they just have a lot of name recognition now. And since all our kids have Chromebooks, I can't really hand them a flash drive and say, here, this is Linux. This is a real operating system. This is how you actually do things on a computer. I can hand a kid a Raspberry Pi and they just take it home and plug it into their TV, because it's HDMI, and that gives them kind of a doorway in, that because most of the kids I have don't have computers at home. Like, they just have their laptop the school gave them. So it's kind of I'm dancing with the devil I know to kind of push the agenda that I want to push. But it is because they're so big and they're so recognizable right now, and they are the darling of the educational community. So they're really easy to get a hold of. If I wanted to say, I don't think they're any better. If I went to my administration and said, hey, I need to buy 30 Odroid C2s, they'd probably be like, you need what? If I go to my administration and say, I need 30 Raspberry Pis, they're like, oh, okay.
What, so you're telling me that you can't install CBIOS and, you know, get all that stuff going on the Chromebooks? Yeah, right. As if they're going to let you do that.
Oh, they can. And I have had kids that do. And I instantly hug them and tell them that they're awesome. But then I have to wipe it and set it back to what it was.
Right, because it's not their device. It's for their use. There is a difference.
Oh, the paperwork.
That is the difference between, like, say, my company-issued iPhone 6 Plus, which is really, you know, ostensibly for testing, and I do nothing with it, and my Moto G4, which, you know, I'm pretty close to software, you know, unlocking and playing with. It's one is my device and one is for my use.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the draconian paperwork we make the parents sign for the laptops that we give them, it's ridiculous, but they signed it, so, and it's my job to enforce it, which sucks.
And, yeah, whereas the Raspberry Pi 3 is only $35, isn't it? It's at that point, it's not disposable, but compared to the price of a Chromebook, which has got to be $100 plus at least, I mean, maybe even $150, $200.
Oh, the kids that I teach, well, I did teach, I don't anymore. They took it away from me so I could teach another math class when we go back next week. But I was teaching like a Python programming class. And so we were using little web-based Python IDEs to do things, and the kids would get so frustrated by it because it was like six layers of jank on top of itself just to get this to run in the browser. And then I'm kind of like, hey, come here, and I just hand them a Raspberry Pi. I'm like, go home, plug this in, plug in your keyboard and mouse, and do some real coding. And it got to the point where the kids were literally bringing them in to school and plugging that we would go to an old computer lab, and they would unplug the other computers and plug these in so they could actually do coding to get that done. And I mean, yeah, it's way disposable, and the parents can't afford to go buy a computer, but they can usually scrounge up $35. And if they can't, I've got a box of them that I bought for that purpose to hand out.
Do you not have problems with connectivity in terms of the fact that it's HDMI only and it doesn't support VGA? I mean, you talk about the old computer lab there. Presumably those screens were VGA and you needed some sort of converter then.
I have an entire box of VGA to HDMI converters because when we gave the teachers their Chromebooks, because their main machine is a Chromebook now, to connect it to all the projectors and stuff in the building, because all that was wired through the walls and stuff, it was already VGA. So we bought probably 200 of these little adapters. So I just have a bunch laying around.
I was going to say, also, you don't have any problems with that, video cards are cheap.
Yeah, I think they cost like $6 a piece or something. I mean, it was ridiculously cheap to buy a bunch of them.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.